Thank you. If I can just start by introducing on my left, Mr. Salih Salih, who is the Group Financial Director, Mr. Hugo Ivy, who is the Group Executive on Human Resources, Lady in Yellow, most of you know, Poppy Beloy, the Group Executive on Corporate Affairs, next to her, Patience Mashungwa, who is recently appointed as Group Executive on Transformation, Lana Kinley, Group Executive on Strategy Implementation, and Sam Bash, who looks after our press liaison. If I can just, Chair, just announce the absence of the Chairman of the group, Dr. Sabisi. Unfortunately, his mother passed away last night, and our condolences go to him. Unfortunately, we were not at that late stage able to bring in another one of our board members.
Let me just, sorry, add a message to thank, first and foremost, let me express on behalf of the committee our deep condolences and please convey to Dr. Sabisi our support at this critical time for him and his family. I've already written a little note to him, which will go out this morning. I have also conveyed to him that he did call me yesterday, and he did say that his mother was not very well and he wouldn't be able to arrive this morning. I did convey to him that at some stage during the course of the term we may have to arrange a separate session and interaction with him as the chairperson of the board prior to us finalizing our report during the session. So if you could just messages, if you could please convey that to us on behalf of the committee, and please show them how they appreciate.
Thank you, Pame. Then continue. I just want to, we obviously have a time constraint, an hour and a half, I'm going to try and conclude. There's a lot of documentation. Unfortunately, we've taken a number of the slides out of the actual presentation for sake of expediency from a timing point of view, so please bear with us. The slides might not correlate 100% with the pack. I assume and I take that the fact has been studied, and I also know that many of the members of the committee, Chair, has been with us in our process for the last 2.5 years and come along the journey. So there's a lot of things that we don't really want to go into too much detail, but we're happy to answer for new members. If we can move on, I'd just like to start with a few slides, just really reflecting the background from where Danel comes from over the last 2.5 years. And I think if we look back towards the period in 2005, you see the headlines of most of the press articles extremely negative. In fact, you'll recall that virtually on a daily basis there was something coming out in the press about the financial position of Danel, about the retrenchments, the possible retrenchments, about the recapitalization that would be required to turn Danel around, and a number of those issues. That sort of started changing as the strategy of Danel started becoming imminent and better understood by the public. It went hand in hand with a number of discussions that we had with international and local partners. You see the headlines such as firm support for Danel, that sets its sights on Europe. We net $400 million from asset sales, etc. As the strategy starts unfolding, one also sees that the news and the support for the company starts improving. We look at Danel Supply's Airbus tail structures and a number of new deals that came out of that environment, Eurocopter accreditation, missile deals in Brazil, etc. And the Fitch ratings, which confirms the support for Danel as we go forward. Right on the top on the left-hand side, we see Danel lands the biggest deal in its history, which is an 8 billion rand contract. And a number of other activities, one of the most prevalent there being the fact that we teamed up in one of our organizations with Carl Zeiss, one of the most credible technology companies from a global perspective. Continual good news, Danel gets German arm in the deal, and commits to 70% local content, all the things running in the right direction. And this really summarizes, I think, what's also happening inside the organization. Just going back to where we started 2.5 years ago, Danel offers an impressive product and service portfolio. We must reiterate that there is no company in the world that can do what Danel does. industry. No single company in the world that does what Danel does, which is good, and it's also bad. Because if you look at what we actually are able to do on that picture, and on this picture over here, every one of these are ground root design activities from high-level engineers, meaning that we are a highly vertically integrated organization. Many companies across the world do aspects of what we do. Even the biggest companies, the EADSs, the BAEs, the General Dynamics, do parts of what we do, but not everything. And this has led to this problem that we're faced with, which is a fixed cost problem, which is fundamentally the problem that Danel sits with and sat with 2.5 years ago. Fixed costs, on the one hand, and the lack of revenue to support that huge product portfolio and the engineering capacity that the company built up over many years. Insufficient local sales on the back of a reduction of defense spend by some 80%. So our fixed cost base grew by 10% per annum and revenue reduced from the local environment by 80%. Export business is taking place in fragmented export markets, mostly developing countries. This export business is start-stop type business, a very, very low margin. Generally less politically stable markets. Huge cost of sale for us trying to do business in 30 to 40 countries around the world. And we said that these markets, by laying on price and no long-term repeat order business, is achieved from an export perspective. Process of discovery was started. Many, many legal agreements with, quite frankly, and legacy contracts. We sit in many of our businesses with contracts that will be living with us for the next 3 to 5 years at negative margins. So a huge percentage of our sales is at negative margin. We don't make any money until that contract is washed out of the system. An extremely poor delivery culture, which we've spoken about before. We never deliver on time within the quality specifications and within the cost parameters that were set for a particular project. Poor management skills throughout the organization, huge governance issues, and many, many labor issues. During the process of discovery, and we'll see it in the strategy pillars and the strategy imperatives, discussions with stakeholders to improve our order cover locally as well as internationally, discussions with industry to improve synergies. When we started 2.5 years ago, absolutely no discussion between Danel and its counterparts in the market, and also no discussion between Danel, Armscor, the DoD, or the SANDF. We started renegotiating various contracts and looked at terminating others. Of great value to the group and the re-engineering of the balance sheet was the ability to sell off a number of non-core assets, both properties and organizations, which has raised over R1 billion cash for the organization. We brought in a lot of new improved management skills at all levels as we unbundled the organization from a single company to a holding company at the top with 8 organizations below. We brought in new CEOs, CFOs, and a whole lot of other skills. Traditionally, what happens in businesses, traditionally, technology companies like Danel around the world found that all positions were filled by engineers. Engineers who were great at being engineers, but became bored of being engineers, and so they became the HR managers, the financial managers, the general managers, the everything else. And quite frankly, to be a financial manager, you need to be qualified, not just an engineer with a good aptitude for sums. And we found ourselves in a position where we were flooded in all activities of our business with a lack of properly developed skills for the particular function that was required. Through the unbundling of Danel, the implementation of independent companies, we've got board of directors, audit committees, internal audit committees, and that has flowed down from a central perspective now into each business, which means that we are now able to manage governance and compliance issues and the quality at the level at which it takes place. 7 organized labor unions involved in the company. I think if we reflect back where we were 2.5, 3 years ago, there were continuing issues from the labor front. And, you know, we're humble about the job we've done, but quite frankly, I think there's very, very little that's appeared anywhere. And any repercussions from poor labor relations in the last 2.5 years. So I think we're stabilizing that situation, and we certainly got organized labor working with us. If we look at the financial indicators, We started from this perspective where from 1997 you can see the business lost money on an annual basis, hundreds of millions of rands annually. And then end of 2005 we lost 1.7 billion rand, which is not on this chart. And in 2006 we lost 1.3 billion rand. And then obviously the results for this year show an upturn again to a loss of about 500 million rand, which is a huge turnaround. In terms of the strategy update, just to remind everybody, when we started 2.5 years ago, we said, what do we want to achieve? What does fixing the norm mean? And we scoped and created a mandate between ourselves and the Department of Public Enterprises as to what fixing the norm means. One of the big challenges for us is that we didn't have a single view, a single vision from the shareholder perspective or from the board or from the executive as to what that actually means to fix the norm. And we redefined it. Basically, we said we needed to become a profitable, commercially viable company, delivering consistent and real growth, attracting, developing, retaining, appropriately awarding world-class skills, world-class productivity, partnering with state agencies to meet the defense needs of the country, and developing partnerships and aligned ventures with true value add. From that mandate, we created a strategy, and I'll take you through that process very briefly. It is important to note that from day one, when the strategy for Denel was redeveloped at the end of June 2005, we have not moved one inch from the initial strategy which was developed and proposed and accepted, which I think has helped us to remain very focused on achieving the challenge that we have in terms of the definition put up here. Key messages that we looked at in terms of developing the strategy. And very quickly, we said that most defense contractors are highly reliant on their domestic markets. Furthermore, changes in the industry are forcing players to consolidate, to build alliances, and carefully focus their businesses. If we look at that definition relative to where Denel was, quite frankly, we had no reliance on the domestic market. We were not consolidated. We were completely fragmented, both locally and abroad. We had no alliances of any note whatsoever. And we were absolutely not focused, which is depicted in the graphs and the figures we showed up front, who quite frankly were just doing everything for everybody. So that was one of the key messages we had to look at. The second one was Denel no longer has a large domestic market to provide the scale to succeed as an independent global systems integrator. Because what Denel had done is it positioned itself as a prime contractor on the global market, competing with the biggest players in the world. And we said that to do that, you need a large domestic market to give you the critical mass and the base load. And we didn't have that any longer, which meant we needed to move from being a global prime contractor to be a subcontractor on the global market, to subcontract to major players around the world, but to be a prime contractor in the local market. To succeed, you know, is pursuing a strategy based on prime contracting the domestic market and the export of systems and components to selected equity partners and alliances with global prime contractors. A major, major change to the function and the strategic imperatives for Denel. Most defense contractors depend on a captive domestic market to achieve the necessary scale for the reasons that we look at in terms of the characteristics of the defense industry. The global defense industry has undergone significant change over the past decade, and the pace of change will increase. The forces for change include declining defense spends around the world. 20 years ago, upward of 7% of GDP of the major nations around the world was spent on defense. Today, it's between 3 and 4%. And in South Africa, it's sitting at about 2.5%. So that was one of the major issues that we needed to look at in terms of restructuring to know. Secondly, the changing nature of conflicts and shifting customer needs. The type of warfare today and the type of equipment that you need for peacekeeping activities, for the terrorist type of activities versus the legacy sort of open battlefield type of technologies meant that Denel had to seriously look at that and structure its organization accordingly. Declining defense spend and increasing R&D costs have driven consolidation of prime contractors across all sectors. This is a really, really key message, and in particular, for our Department of Defense and the SANDF and Arms Corps to understand. If you look at the middle slide there, you see in 1992 in the US there were over 30 companies operating in this environment. Today there's 5. Those 5 have bought all the smaller players. The reason for that is that those smaller players could not afford to remain competitive because they didn't have the funds, they didn't have the balance sheet to continuously invest in people and R&D to be able to remain competitive. This slide also links in very similarly to the automotive industry. In 1990, there were 36 manufacturers around the world. Today there's 8. And the reason is critical mass. It's R&D, it's balance sheet. And we said that we needed to understand this from a South African industry perspective. And based on this trend, we needed to say what is the Denel's strategy going to look like going forward. Looking ahead, we said successful players will require both privileged access and commercial orientation. In terms of privileged access, we said a captive market, a large domestic demand and guaranteed access to domestic programs. And probably one of the biggest activities that we've been driving in the last 2.5 years is to map DoD's expenditure with industry capacity. We have to map. It does not help that we have capacity and there's no flow coming from the Department of Defense. So privileged access for industry, not for Denel, but for industry in total. We need a captive market. All defense industries around the world generate upward of 70 to 80% of their revenue from the local market. That gives them a base load and the opportunity to go and explore international business. Secondly, political support, consistent active support from government for export sales. And secondly, commercial orientation, absolute focus, very strong reliance, and excellence in execution. Those were some of the fundamentals that we said were required to be a successful player in this industry. If we look at the left-hand part of the slide, you'll see that the defense spend from 1985 deteriorated to about 1998, and then it increased quite dramatically. But if you look at the right-hand side, you see Denel did not participate in this recovery, neither did the rest of industry in South Africa. The yellow line demonstrates Denel's revenue and its decline. And the reason that happened was because since 1998, the defense packages took place. And the spend took place on equipment that Denel and other local players did not provide. And this is where we talk about mapping capacity with expenditure. You cannot just stop spending in the local market to go and spend 5 years internationally with the local industry, which has a fixed cost base not being looked after. This led, and that's very closely to the graph I showed you earlier, where the financial results from 1997 showed a loss every year for the last 10 years. So those five industry success factors that we put on the table, we said should form the founding principle of the future to know. Those fundamental five issues, what would it make, what does it take to be a successful player? We said those founding principles, our founding principles should be based on those issues. And we created then five pillar strategy. We spoke about securing privileged access to a guaranteed minimum proportion so that we can spend, partnering the state agencies, the DoD, DTI, DPE, Treasury, etc., to make sure that we're all working in a single direction. We needed to focus on growing the commercially viable businesses where there now is real technological leadership and other businesses ring-fenced or operated under management contracts or exited. We embarked on a process for 18 months to understand which of our businesses could make it and which couldn't. We could only do that by unbundling those companies from the big conglomerate that we had. And in the last 18 months, we were then clearly able to identify strategies for each of our businesses. We needed to secure scale, critical mass, and access to market through equity business partnerships with major global players. In other words, selling equity of our organizations to companies who could help us to retain these organizations, and we needed to raise our capabilities and productivity to world-class standards. Strategy imperatives also dictated that we move from the left-hand part of this slide to the right-hand side. This was the first slide I ever showed my board and my executive when I joined, and I don't do any presentation without this slide. And that says we needed to move from the left to the right. I think we made huge progress. If we were north out of 10, 2.5 years ago, I think we had 4 or 5 out of 10. And I will repeat a few times today that unless we can move faster towards a single vision from all stakeholders for this organization, Denel will not will not ultimately be a sustainable organization. I am comfortable that we're making huge progress, but we are not where we need to be in terms of moving from the left to the right. The five pillars of the macro strategy were then put on a foundation stone, which is the foundation of transformation. Implement effective transformation and people management throughout the organization, which is the foundation. And there's a number of initiatives and activities around the concept of transformation in all the aspects of transformation. And based on that foundation stone, we have the five pillars, and that's what we've been driving for the last 2.5 years. If we look at the business units themselves, we just start now with a very, very clean organizational structure, which is the Denel Pty Limited, which is being positioned to be an investment holding company. We started 2.5 years ago with 200 people in the Pty Limited, and all the power of the total group sat within those people sitting at head office. The business units were disempowered entirely. All the power was taking place, and everything was standardized in the center. We unbundled that, created separate businesses. Each business is so radically different from the other that you cannot standardize a single approach. The Denel Pty Limited head office now consists of about 50 people. We reduced the cost there from about 180 million to about 80 million rand. We have a target to drive that down as we go into the future. On the slide, you will also see the success that we've had with the equity partnerships and the rollout of the strategy. On the right-hand side, you see Turbomeca Africa. We have a 49% shareholding, Coles Rice Electronics, we have a 30% shareholding of that company, Denel Saab Aerostructures, we have an 80% shareholding, but Saab have an option to take on a majority share within the next 24 months. In the case of Coles Rice Electronics, just to give you some indicators, company which turns about 300 million rand a year, losing about 150 to 200 million rand a year in net profit. Coles Rice had come in, made a huge amount of changes, brought a lot of business from the international environment, helped us with processes and systems and management, and that business will break even in the next 24 months and will be a highly successful technology company. Chair, I'm not going to go through the details on each of the businesses themselves. I have updated you, the Saab Denel Aerostructures was completed in 2007, Zeiss Electronics 2007, Turbomeca Africa previously. Our Denel Munitions Company, which consists of 7 plants, an equity transaction was proposed and approved by the Denel Board, and it's sitting at PFMA application status at the moment. And on our UAV business, very exciting, the 2 UAV companies in South Africa, and we have proposed and had the board accept the proposal of a consolidation of the 2 UAV companies in South Africa into a single company, which is in line with our strategy. In terms of the businesses, I'm not going to go through too much detail on each of the slides. Our munitions business, turnover currently about 1.1 billion rand, 3,100 staff. We lost last year about 18 million rand net profit in this business. We made some very, very strong proposals to the board, which have been supported. And hopefully we will now be able to resolve this company as we go forward. One of the major issues for this business is reflected on this slide. If you look at 2007-2008, on the left-hand side, relative to the thick red horizontal line, which is the break-even of this organization in sales, you'll see that you don't get to break-even. The red line reflects export business, the red shaded area, or the solid red reflects export business, the solid blue reflects local business, and the shaded blue and red are potential business as we go forward. Now, one of the big problems here is that we have 7 plants vertically integrated, 3,100 people. We are nowhere near our break-even point. And the biggest concern for us in this business, we have no idea when, if, and how much the DoD are going to be spending on munitions in next year, the year after, or the year thereafter. So the challenge for us is to work with the Department of Defense, with Arms Corps, with the SANDF, and with Treasury to understand how are we going to fund the fixed cost which has given us a break-even of 1.3 billion. And that's a problem for us because we are not moving forward in terms of achieving the information that we need to be able to plan this business in terms of supply chain, inevitably, when we get orders, we're procuring raw materials at a premium because we don't have advance notice of when this equipment is going to be required. Typically around the world, defense contractors like ourselves get 5-year frame agreements. You get a 5-year frame agreement saying we can spend R1 billion, and we'll confirm the details of that on an annual basis, which allows you to plan your capacity, allows you to organize your supply chain, and to create the necessary efficiencies. We're far short of orders for the current year or future years. We have a break-even of $1.2 billion. The current local orders from the SANDF has averaged $120 million a year. We spoke earlier about our export business, which is very fragmented and at low margin. And very often, in this environment, we are securing export business at negative margins purely to get the throughput through the factory. We have uncertainty with regard to further orders to be placed for the current year by the SANDF. And we have said that this business is likely to become insolvent by the end of the current financial year. The alternatives proposed are not implemented. We have proposed alternatives. Those alternatives have been signed off and approved by the board, and they're now in process, and hopefully through the PFMA side of things and TPE's activities with Treasury and DOT, we can move forward with the recommendations that we've made in this business. And now aviation is where we support the military fixed wing and rotary wing activities, as well as some commercial type of activity. 550 million turnover and 1,300 people. This business made a net profit last year of R20 million, in line with our new strategy. I think what is important, and I'm just going to go over here, is one of the major issues we've discovered and working very closely with the South African Air Force is that there's a huge duplication between the South African Air Force and Denel Aviation in areas of manpower, equipment and facilities. So for every warehouse I have, they have one. For every technician I have, they have one. For every spare part I have, they have one. For every diagnostic piece of equipment I have, they have one. For all the accreditations and the training and development of people that they have, I have one. And so what we sit and talk to the staff about is saying that doesn't make sense. If one looks at what's happening in the global environment, air forces are focusing on military excellence, and they are outsourcing maintenance and support to private sector. In our case, private sector is Denel Aviation, which is owned by the government, and hence we are now moving forward, which is supported by the Chief of the SANDF and the Chief of the Air Force, to finding and migrating to a scenario where we will have single capabilities between the Air Force and ourselves, reducing costs dramatically and improving efficiencies. As such, a model of single source supply will be required for the new generation platforms. The Airbus A109, the Airbus, the A400M, the Gripens that are coming in, instead of us duplicating between the Denel Aviation and the Air Force, that have a single capability, which we split in a manner which makes sense from a financial perspective. I think this is very much indicative of the good news, of the great work that's been done between the Denel and the DoD and Arms Corps and various areas of the military environment to say how do we actually reduce costs and improve efficiencies and ensure operational uptime on the platforms that they need to operate. On Royfog, we've spoken about this at length. I think just to confirm, Denel, as the design authority, will continue to provide after-sales support once the delivery of the 12 helicopters is completed. I think there is still a debate which needs to be had by the owner of the aircraft, which is Arms Corps and the SAF and the SANDF, as to how they support 12 aircraft post the delivery and when these aircraft become commissioned in 3 years' time. I'm not quite sure how they and how we deal with that supportability post delivery of the aircraft. Denel Dynamics, which is our missile business, probably the highest level of engineering capacity in the country, business in huge turmoil at the moment. It's fundamentally an R&D type of capability. Most of the revenue of the 700 odd million invested, 400-500 million in development projects, and on development projects you don't make profits. And Denel's vision and mandate is to become a commercially viable entity. So we have to review very seriously how we move forward with a company like this, working with all the stakeholders to see how we stabilize this company going forward. On Denel Land Systems, this is the business where we develop artillery systems, the famous G5 and G6, a lot of light infantry weapon systems, a world-class organization, currently a turnover of about 430 million, 440 people. This is the business in which we just won the 8 billion rand contract. And if you just have a look at the impact that will have in the financial rewards of this company over the forthcoming years, you can see by 2009, 2010 we get close to a break-even scenario, and then we start getting into across the break-even line in 2010-11, and then you see the profitability kicking through tremendously on the back of this industrial program. The downflow opportunities for the rest of the industry and numerous tens of other companies will obviously benefit as we outsource a lot of the activities of this program. Forgive me, Chair, but I'm running through some of the other businesses where there aren't major issues, but there might be questions. So that just sums up the business unit status. I'm sure the members have gone through the pack. There might be some questions afterwards on the specific businesses. If I can hand over to Talib, who will just deal with the financial results.
Thank you, Sean. On the results that we posted for the year ending March 2007, we've shown a significant improvement on our bottom line, moving from a loss at March 2006 of 1.4 billion to a loss of 549 million. That improvement was driven largely by the growth in turnover. You would see that increased by almost 500 million rand, and at the same time our gross profit improved by about 900 million rand. So what we did experience in the organization was better control of the contracts, better contract execution, and cost control at a production level. And that caused our gross profit to be much better. Moving on to the next slide, where we break the income statement down in a bit more detail. And you would see that our GP as a percentage of revenue improved significantly from where we were at March 2006 to 23%. It was also much better than the budget of 15%. So again, reflecting a better cost control and the and contract execution. At the same time, in our gross profit, we released certain production-orientated provisions in there as well. On our operating cost line, although you see the operating costs went up marginally from 1.1 billion in the March 2006 year to 1.257 billion, if you remove certain once-off adjustments which we had to make, in fact, our operating costs compared to year-on-year decreased by 6%. And that again comes back to that loss of 549 against the 1.4 billion. We've performed better than budget. Our budgeted loss for the year was 684 million, and the principal reason why we performed better than budget relates to the other income that we generated of over 100 million rand, and this includes a substantial amount of external revenue. A significant portion of that relates to the progress we've made in selling off our non-core assets. On the balance sheet, the point that I'd like to highlight here is our solvency position, where at the end of March 2007, we posted a net solvency position of 633 million. We still have a lot of work to do on trade receivables and on inventories in terms of cash flows, but due to the difficult context that we have, the complex global environment we operate in, some of our inventories require long lead items, and hence we have a build-up of inventory. But this is something that's receiving ongoing management attention. Onto our cash flow statement, you would notice that in the March 2007 year, our cash flow that we've utilized in the organization before financing activities of 945 million, that compares favorably to the almost 1 billion rand that we utilized in the previous year in March 2006. In the cash flow from financing activities, you see that's a positive of 1.4 billion. That's after accounting for the 2.2 billion rand that we received for the year ending March 2006 as recap funding. And in the year ending March 2007, we received a further 567 million rand from government, and that's included in the number that you see there of 555 million. So at the end of the year, we posted a cash position in our financial statements of at the bottom of that column in March 2007 of 338 million against last year of 730 million, and all of the cash that we was used in the working capital operations of the now. Okay, then on the director's report, just some of the points that I have made here, so I'm not, just for the interest of time, I'm not going to go to it in more detail. Except to say the cost of sales line, as you would have seen, that's of 105% last year, and it's improved to 77% as a percentage of sales. And our operating costs, this to demonstrate our focus on keeping our operating costs down to a minimum, reduced from 42% of sales to 38% of sales. Thank you.
Chair, one of the big issues for Danel, every business has two sides. The one side is the systems, the processes, the contract management, the organizational structure, which we talk about, the left-hand side, the internal issues. Critically, the order pipeline, the sales, and if we look at the problem for Danel relative to fixed costs, is the lack of sales. A huge, huge issue for us. So we spent a lot of time trying to analyze what the potential sales position could be going forward. On the graph that we reflect over here, you'll see that in 2007-2008, as of September, we had close to 90% order cover in terms of the sales that we need to achieve for this year to make our budget. If we just focus on that graph at this point in time, last year, at this point in time, we were sitting at 40%. Okay? The year before that, we started the year with about 30% order cover. Last year, we started the year with 35% order cover. This year, we started the year with about 75% order cover. And the current year-to-date scenario, the latest information is that we're sitting at 95% order cover. Major focus on driving not only sales for the particular year, but ensuring that we can start each year with a decent level of sales. In a defense environment, you need to be sitting at 80% sales order cover at the beginning of the year. If you don't sit at 80%, you can't make it. Last year, we sat at 40%. The year before, at 30%. This year, we're at 75%. So we hope to drive that 08-09 line up to around about 80% before the year commences. And we have a huge program internally to drive the pipeline and future orders of this organization. Just in terms of positive progress as far as the stakeholder base is concerned, the SANDF, DOD and Arms Corps now seem to understand the issues of Danel and South African defense-related industries and are more willing to find solutions, although long-term orders are still an issue. There's far more interaction taking place at all levels, including progressive interactions with the South African defense-related industry role players. The DOD community is interacting well across the Danel and Danel divisions, and the contract and awarding of the UFASTER, the 8 billion rand contract, is a great contributor to the overall industry motivation, a result of collective drive from all stakeholders. This contract has been imminent for 4 to 5 years, and the eventual conclusion thereof is obviously a huge boost to the entire industry. Internal to Danel, the unbundling into separate entities is progressing well. Focus on project delivery is on schedule and at specified quality levels. Processes and systems are improving dramatically. Cost control, productivity and efficiency is a focus point, which is critical for us. We recently introduced performance management, which has never existed in the company. It's been in existence since the 1st of April this year, which goes hand in hand with a total change to the remuneration policy in the company, and Hugo will talk about that in a few minutes. Customer focus, sales pipeline management we've spoken about, and transformation of the business culture and the diversity within the organization. GBAS, the Ground-Based Air Defense System, which might have been presented, which was a major problem for the Department of Defense, we're only highlighting this, in terms of our interactions with the SANB Economics Board, to know we're far behind on this program. It is creating huge embarrassment for ourselves and certainly for Arms Corps. Just to confirm that we're online with this major program for the SANDF, and we're looking forward to delivering at the quality levels as we go forward. If we look at 2000 and beyond, Denel Pty Limited, 100% state-owned holding company, 8 to 10 focused Pty Limited companies responsible for their own profit and losses, independent balance sheet, and ring-fenced. Because the businesses are so different from one another, you cannot operate them as a single company. Equity partners bring global expertise, market access, and R&D. Denel's shareholding of these businesses will range between 26 and 100%. Various government and shareholder agreements will protect the intellectual capacity and intellectual property, security of supply for our forces, and include relative preemptive rights for the government. Further consolidation of the industry in South Africa is now possible and feasible, and is demonstrated by the consolidation of our UAV capability with another privately owned company in South Africa. Within 24 to 36 months, Denel will be financially viable on a sustainable basis if the plans, some of which are outside Denel's control, are implemented. We are 100% confident that this strategy, if implemented and we push through with the total stakeholder community, we will be sustainable. If there are interruptions in the rollout, if the stakeholder community do not get to that point on that slide where I said we needed to move from the left to the right, where we agree on the vision and everyone pulls in the right direction, we cannot build sustainability into the total group. It is absolutely critical and something which we're pushing very hard to ensure we agreed on a plan, we have a strategy, we have a direction, let's deliver. And if we all pull in that direction, we can certainly create sustainability for the company. There are a number of issues on the annual report which we thought we should highlight. If I have it correct, the Chair, we still have 45 minutes. So we're running ahead of schedule. We have a number of issues on the annual report. We've only pulled out a couple of slides, 40. We pulled out a couple of slides. I'm going to ask Tarek to deal with them. If the particular slide that you have questions on do not appear right now, we'll deal with it in the question time if we don't mind. Thank you.
In terms of the director's report, the strategy that Sean has outlined to yourselves has been incorporated into our corporate plan that was submitted to the Department of Public Enterprises at the end of February, and we will be updating that plan in terms of the next corporate plan submission, which will also cover a five-year period. We do provide monthly progress reports to both National Treasury and the Department of Public Enterprises in addition to our Board of Directors as well. We believe we've made good progress on our macro strategy as outlined in terms of privileged access, where we've secured the UFACE contract and the ADATA contract over the past year. We've had very positive relationships with the state agencies. We have evaluated the commercial viabilities of all of the entities as pointed out, and raising productivity and capability as well, together with equity partnerships. I did cover this previously, so I'm not going to go into it in any detail. Around the internal controls of Denel, we believe we've made very good and positive progress across the Denel's operations for the past year, to the extent that similarly in the previous year as well, we did receive an unqualified audit opinion. During the past year, we had resolved a number of reportable irregularities. These relate to non-compliances to the PFMA and to the Companies Act. That was reported by the auditors for the year ending March 2006. In the year March 2007, this was a key focus area for us, and we managed to clean up and resolve all of the issues at the Denel Pty Limited level. There were certain areas of non-compliance relating to the PFMA and the Companies Act, which I will cover briefly now. In terms of the treasury regulations, in terms of the PFMA as well, there is a requirement for us to have a fraud prevention policy and plan. We did in fact have a policy that was approved by our audit committee late during the March 2007 year. In October 2007, we had our detailed fraud prevention plan approved, and this is in the process of being implemented across Denel. And it's something that's a standing item on our audit committee agendas, both at the entity level and at the group level. The next aspect of non-compliance related to our internal audit. Our internal audit, we have adopted a risk-based approach. For some of the entities, we did not go ahead and conduct any internal audits over the past year because they were fairly immaterial to the broader Denel organization. And our focus was on the material entities for over the past year. And our internal audit is currently outsourced to PwC. There were two entities where there were a breakdown in control.
The benefits of the other members, that's at the back of the presentation. 93, 94, 95.
Thank you. Okay, in terms of the entities where we've had a breakdown in controls, in the one division related to our properties group, although there were these breakdown in controls, we do not regard them as being significant to the broader group, although significant progress has been made to resolve all of the issues that emerged out of that division. And equally, at Denel Aviation, where we've also had a breakdown in controls, action plans are in place to resolve all of the issues. Both interim and internal audits are taking place in those particular entities. Okay, next aspect that deals with fruitless and wasteful expenditure. As part of our business, we do incur penalties as part of our business. The issue is whether it's under management control or whether it's expenditure that's been incurred in vain and recklessly. We did make presentations to our audit committee, and we have both the audit committee, the board, and management believe that these penalties were not incurred recklessly. They were incurred as part of the normal business operations, and hence they were not classified as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Okay, on the Companies Act, the non-compliance that relates to the Companies Act related to submissions that we have to make to the registrar's office in terms of annual general meeting and various non-compliance issues, we have resolved all of these non-compliance issues post-year-end. Okay, risk management, this is an ongoing exercise that's conducted across Denel. To benchmark ourselves to world-class practices, we did bring in our internal auditors to assist us in ensuring that we've embedded risk management processes across Denel, and this is something that's receiving ongoing attention. We believe we have made significant progress in this regard as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to hand over to Hugo Ivey, who's going to touch on a couple of the HR and transformational issues.
Thank you, Sean, Chair, and members of the House. This particular slide indicates our total numbers within the now. As you can see, there has been a reduction in the total quantity of employees. That's in line with the strategy that we're following. We have reported at the last meeting last year about the social plan activities and so forth that we have in place to deal with instances where we have retrenchments, etc. Again, if one looks at the demographics, there is a slight improvement in the demographics, but I think it's important to understand that we are at a point where the focus is more on the strategy of the organization rather than on the demographics. When we started off, we did not necessarily deal with the transformation issues, but we now have a transformation strategy in place where each of our entities is focused on dealing with those particular aspects as far as demographics as well as the transformation is concerned. There's a further request that I include a slide or two on how we determine remuneration within Denel. And I'll try to capture all really, it's a wide subject, but I'll try to capture within this particular slide. If one looks at the remuneration of the group CEO, that is agreed upon at engagement between the shareholder, which is DPE, the board of directors, and the group CEO itself. But in addition to that, the shareholder and the board of directors make use of benchmarking and surveys, as well as the DPE guidelines on remuneration, which outlines how to go about determining the particular remuneration. the remuneration of the ExCo and entity CEOs has also agreed upon during engagement between the group CEO, representing the shareholder, the entity board and directors, and the following factors are basically taken into account. That is, on the group CEO side, one looks at the size of the entity, beginning to total guaranteed pay, as set out in the remuneration model supplied by public enterprises. We also make use of salary surveys from entities such as Deloitte and Touche and PE Corporate. The same applies for the CEOs and the ExCo. The size of the individual company is taken into account, looking at the salary and wage bill, as well as the pre-tax profits in line with remuneration principles. Market remuneration information, and lastly, all of the remuneration within the entity is governed by the delegation of authorities, which would dictate whether it is approved by the shareholder, whether it's approved by the board, or the ExCo DNA. Just a key point of interest is that DNA in itself is paying within what we term the 25th, and we're attempting to arrive at paying the 25th percentile of the market. Many other companies similar to us are at the 50th percentile or the 75th percentile. Mm-hmm.
Later. We'll get to this particular issue. Let them do the presentation and the time allocated, and then we can have sufficient time in terms of deliberation.
Continue, Chair. The last slide I want to touch on really deals with the incentive scheme. I think within Danel we had a practice where we paid for a job rather than paying for performance. With the effect of 1 April 2007, we've introduced an incentive scheme for all employees within DNA. The previous year, we had an incentive scheme introduced only at a senior executive level in order to ensure that we do not run into difficulty within this particular year. So the scheme that has been introduced encompasses a variable pay portion element, which is based on the agreed-upon target in line with the performance management system that has been implemented. It forms part of the employee's total remuneration, and as I said, it has an element of pay at risk, which means you are contracted. If you achieve your target, the incentive bonus will be payable. If you do not achieve your targets, you will then have a reduction in the pay which you were expected to get. So performance management system has been introduced to link the particular performance of the individual with the pay. On transformation, I've touched on it when I dealt with the numbers. A significant progress has been made. As I mentioned earlier, not as much as we would have wanted it to be, but we have put in systems in place to deal with it. We have transformation portfolio office. This is where our colleague Patience Mishunga is heading that particular portfolio. A transformation framework has been drawn up and approved by our board and by the respective entities' boards. It's been submitted to all those entities. Each of our entities now have transformation champions in place, and the transformation committees are headed up by the respective CEOs of the various entities. Transformation committees that have been established incorporate the CEO, management, the unions, as well as non-unionized labor and human resources facilitators. Comprehensive plans have been drawn up, and these are approved by the group CEO, and they address matters such as business transformation, leadership, diversity, training and development, succession planning, mentorship, a whole list of factors, about 12 elements that is incorporated within there. Progress evaluation and performance reporting are scheduled for November and March, April 2008 respectively. I think key what we have done this time around in Danel is to contract our respective entities on transformation issues. Because we've introduced the performance management system, we have an incentive scheme, we now have contract with our entities accordingly. On the socio-economic development side, we have a DNL Center for Learning and Development, the DCLD. This particular entity really looks at our in-house training requirements, but it also focuses on what the needs are out there in the community in terms of training. We have a partnering strategy adopted with industry and other SOEs. Transnet, Eskom, etc. are participating in this particular school that we're involved with. the printer school that we have in the past used to only focus on aerospace trades. It now focuses on non-aerospace trades as well. That's where we have about a 5-year contract with ESCO to train 100 apprentices per year on the electrical and mechanical apprentice side. So in that context, the school is not only being used for the NAL requirements, it's also being used for the greater GIPSA requirements and so forth. We have a youth foundation training program as well. This particular program has about 295 learners from all over the country, and the learners are sponsored by the DOD, Transnet, ESCOM, and the PPE. The focus of this particular program is on careers in science, engineering, and technology. And we give also extensive schooling in maths and science. And these particular students, many of them, when they finish their Youth Foundation program, are taken up in bursaries and within those various institutions mentioned, DOD, Transnet, and within ourselves. Schools Outreach Program. This is a program we have in the Northwest, and it covers grade 11 and 12 in all 9 provinces. 93% pass rate from this particular program, with 65% of the students having university entrance. The NAL's contribution in the past amounted to about 1.2 million on this particular school's outreach program. Apprentice and Artisan Training School, part of the company's steps to build its skills base. The school covers apprentice and artisan training as well as trade test preparation and revision. And we have at the Artisan School about 253 students for 207, including private and foreign students, and the demographic and gender split is 189 males and 64 females. On the BEE side, also an element which has been addressed within our transformation structures, but just the numbers for BEE spend for the last year and the year before that, you would see that our total procurement in 2006-07 was about 1.8 billion. We planned to spend about 308 million on BEE, and our actual spend was 380 million there. So about 21% of our total spend. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Chair.
This is the final slide, Chair. Just in conclusion, then, the turnaround strategy is on track. I think it's fair to say that the company has not turned around. The turnaround strategy is on track. We are under no illusions as to the work that we still have to do. Indicators on the right direction, discussions, communication taking place with all stakeholders, government departments and organized labor and employees, our customers and our alliances around the world. Forward sales focus is starting to bear fruit, as is imminent, in the growth in our sales last year. We look at growing our sales this year again by some 15 to 18%. We look at being 15 to 18% up on our sales this year on last year. On-score unbundling and the Dairy Defense Evaluation and Research Institute, the creation thereof, has a potential impact on the momentum. We are aware of that. We're working with all the stakeholders to make sure that does not impact on the momentum that we've created. And we have a strong view that South African defense-related industries should consolidate further so that Denel is not seen as this highly protected monster, but rather that she is seen as an industry player who's interested in the success of the overall industry. And visibility of certain procurement budgets are not yet clear from the DOD and Arms Corps. We are working with them to ensure that we can map capacity with expenditure, and that will help us all to plan a lot better for the future. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you,
Mr.
Ginsburg, and thank you, team. What I want to suggest is, please, we need to save some time. There's more time for the committee to do that. It is possible to reduce the presentation of 2 hours to 1 hour. What I'm going to suggest to members is that we break up the interactions into the three major components. The one is the overall presentation by the CEO. The other one is the financial aspects, and then the third element is the HR aspects. I want us to just start with some questions. Because Ms. Anderson wanted to also ask questions, I imagine, on clarity and so on. Let's start with the HR thing, because that's pretty focused. That should take us to half past where we'll break for tea and then come back for the more detailed part of the session on the issue of the financial statement, as well as the overall presentation by the CEO. So HR staff members, I've got Mr. Van Dijk, Mr. Kololo, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. No, the clarification I wanted to know.
No. You're next. You're after Mr. Kololo now. I didn't see your hand.
Oh, I thought you...
No. Okay, and Mr. Wang. So we've got four people. Any other takers? Can't see. What? Oh. Okay, you're right here, and I'm looking at my and now we're six takers. So let's make it no more than two questions per person at this stage, and then we might have a second round if there's more interest on the HR. Okay? Van Dijk?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, according to information, Danel has 13 directors who serve on 111 different directorships. Now, what about the CEO? Are you not of the opinion that because of that, they cannot contribute properly to Danel's business and that it contributes to Danel's poor performance? Can you just inform us on that? The second question, Chair.
Sorry, Mr. Sundyke, I was just grabbing my pen, wasn't working when you were saying. Just repeat that question for me so that I get the essence of it.
Oh, I'm sorry. According to the information, Danel has 13 directors who serve on 111 different directorships. At the stage when you got the information. I want to know whether the CEO is not of the opinion that because of that, the directors cannot contribute properly to the Danel's business and that it contributes to the poor performance.
Okay.
The second question, Chair, is it true that certain personnel at the Kopervaag testing ground who made a contribution to make that specific area profitable receive only a 140 rand per month increase in salary, while some managers they receive between 50,000 to 80,000 increase, apparently approved by the chief executive officer. Can you inform us on this? Is it true or not? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Mr. Sundyke obviously has a source of information that the rest of us don't. I've got Mr. Kololo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine actually will be on the. I'll be interested to know on the youth development program as to what is the criteria that you use there, because I see that you've got quite a number of students. Are you going province by province? Where are they coming from? Because in our areas where we come from, for instance, we've got so many students who excel in these science subjects like mathematics, physics and chemistry and so on. So how do they get in touch with you for this program? I think that should be the only one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lolo. Mr. Hendrickson.
Thank you, Chairperson. The clarification I wanted earlier on was there was a reference to 25% quartile. I wanted to know if it was at the top 25% or the lower, so I wasn't quite sure how you're using it. I use it in the top 25 or the lower 25%. My questions, Chairperson, would be just to join with Mr. Van Dijk when he said there are 111 directorships held by 12 directors. And I noticed that Mr. Palati serves on 30 different boards and he's only attended 3 out of the 8 meetings. Mr. Kuneri serves on 16. And there are, I think, 3 others with 9 or more boards that they serve on. And I also asked, will you give us the figures of board attendance that you make it out of? Because people are appointed at different times. So, for example, you've attended 2 meetings out of 3 or 2 out of 5. It would just help us to get that shit. And I think, can I just to contextualize this for members of the Nelshed business, Earlier this year, we requested the ministry to provide us with a list of directorships of all directors of SOEs. And we were shocked at some of the names that we saw there. So that's where the question comes from. I think it will also be useful if, when you, in your annual report, you tell us who your directors are. SAA, for example, listed all the other boards that their directors serve on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks, sir. I've got... Mr. Wang, who was first? Okay.
Thank you. You can sit. My question is related to the fact that the, I don't see in the slide any reference to the digital action that we're taking against the managers, whether they were, there was nothing at all. And secondly, we forgot to read the report says no more. What is it called? Is that some caused by the restructuring that is taking place within the company? What remedy program that is there now to ensure that?
Thank you, Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Chairperson. The one question I wanted to know is on research and development costs, at what percentage it's happening at the moment? I see on the annual report that somewhere it says, toward the back of the financial notes, it says 149 million. I don't know, at what percentage costs?
You're talking about the human resources cost.
Well, no, research and development in particular.
Well, we'll get to that part. We're dealing with HR now.
Oh, with HR.
Yes.
Okay, that's right.
Okay. So, do you have a question on HR as well?
No.
No? Okay, Mr. Cotswold?
Thanks, Chief. On your on page 82, where your list of employees, no mention of physically challenged employees. Have you got a program in place to make those? And also on Mr. Polaro's question about the youth development program. Say you've got a youngster that wants to become a pilot. What would be the general and the procedures going to follow to sort of get
pilot.
Yes.
Pilot. I had Ms. McConville.
Okay, on page 84 of this one, I see that the incentive bonus is meant for all employees. Is it really from the top employee to the last bottom employee that the incentive bonus applies? And my second question is on, I also see on page 84 the last bullet, in terms of the performance management, even though on the page earlier on 83, in terms of the factors that are taken into account when on remuneration, it doesn't make reference to performance management. Am I correct to say linking remuneration with performance management is only something that has just been introduced?
Okay.
Okay.
Those are the red of questions. Let me just add.
I'm sorry, Chair. Please, my second question related to the board of directors. Am I correct to say I'm representing Peter here as well? To say, if you look at Ms. Mulder, I'm sorry. She has attended 100% of the board meeting, and she only serves on two other. She only has two other directors. Also. Could that be contributing to her 100% attendance? I'm only also hoping that the contribution as well is 100%.
We should introduce performance management for board members now. The pay is linked to risk. let me just on the incentive bonus thing, if you could just explain a little bit about the issue that you raised. I must say it's the first time I've ever heard of a pay-at-risk principle, which is quite interesting to me. And maybe if you elaborate on that and tell us exactly how it works, because I found and perhaps it applies in different ways, so it is, but the first time that I've come across it, I'd be very interested to see. Whether in fact, I mean, one of the big problems is with the trying to get buy-in from labor unions as well, and how you manage that process. Just give us some sense of that would be very interesting.
Okay, so
let's
do that immediately. Because there's a whole host of other questions, but on the exchange, on the issue of pay at risk, I think in a nutshell, what we are saying is, if an individual is on a fixed pay, argument's sake of R1 million, let's use round numbers, and
I was going to ask if that's the average.
just for ease of reference, we would have what we call a 40% incentive on that. Now, 40% would then imply that he is effectively on 800,000, 400,000 of that, which represents the 40%, is at risk. So he is then contracted accordingly. So if he achieves 100%, he will only get 20%. But if he goes above that, he will then get the full 40%. So he has an element of his pay that is at risk. Just interesting in discussions with the unions, because when you start talking of 40% or 20% or 10%, it becomes an attractive thing to say, give me 40%. But if you then indicate to an individual that you're on 100,000, if we use 40%, you're effectively on a fixed pay of 60,000. Can we do that? Immediately, the back of this, and now we actually don't have so much control over what happens. We feel that we should be on the 10%, which is recommended for the level of risk that that particular position has. So that's what we mean by pay at risk. The higher you are within the organization, you have a lot more control over where the entity is going, so you should have a higher portion of your pay at risk. The lower you are within the organization, you have less control, although you do make a contribution, and that is why we have, in a particular incentive scheme we've introduced with Internet, a 10% category for that group, which is the pay at risk. So if the entity or your particular entity or department where you are does not achieve its objectives, you would then lose a 10% of what you would have potentially earned.
That would be a fixed salary. You would lose 10% of fixed salary.
It would be 10% of your fixed salary at that level. And it also answers the question that the lady has asked to say, are we contracting everyone within the company? We are. Every single employee today in Janelle has a letter that explains to you what is his fixed pay portion and what is his variable or the pay at risk portion.
Since when was this introduced?
It was introduced 1st of April this year. But we had, for very good reasons, last year we had an interim incentive in place. Because, you know, if you introduce something next year, and you tell everyone that next year this is what we're going to do, this year you have a whole host of banking happening. So we had an interim arrangement for last year, and this year, well, the annual salary increases in April, which we've also, by the way, moved from June, because it was in June last year, to April, to coincide with our financial year. Each employee within the now received a letter that indicated those particular aspects of the remuneration and incentive scheme.
Please note that in the next reporting year, that one of the things that we would want to see is a full analysis and a full report on whether in fact incentives were achieved and the kind of level at which they were achieved and where they weren't achieved.
Okay, correct. I think important that an entity which doesn't make its numbers obviously would not get anything.
The rest of the follow-up on that one, okay?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to ask, does that mean that, for instance, if Dinel incurs losses, huge losses, then it means all the employees are going to their salaries are going to be cut down and the bonuses and everything to the top management. What does that mean?
I think it depends which entity you find
yourself. Okay, if I may just clarify, I think one of the biggest problems that Danel experienced in the past was that Danel's whole performance and reward mechanism was based on the entire Danel achieving. Now it's very difficult knowing Danel the way we know that there are many risks within Danel. You can have 10 of the entities doing very well and one has huge losses and the whole of Danel is under. But unfortunately, the previous model was based on the whole of Danel achieving. The current model that we're following is one where we say, here are the separate entities. These guys are responsible for their business. If they achieve their numbers, we have to make and honor the commitment we've made to pay them out the incentives. Because that's the performance that we want to drive. There's no point we penalize them because the another entity on the other side did not do what it's supposed to do. And they actually have absolutely no control of it. So it is, in a way, decentralized from where we were in the past with the centralized. Unfortunately, we will have situations where the entity, Danel, is seen to have achieved X number, and then there would be questions as to, but why did you still pay out bonuses? But it's important that one recognize that we're driving incentives and we want to incentivize people for the areas where they have control of.
Please continue with the other question.
Can I just start? Can I just for clarity purposes, because it could have been misconstrued, no one loses any aspect of their fixed salary in this process. If you have a fixed salary, you have a fixed salary, because you need to know you've got X money for bread and milk and your kids. So what we've done is move from a fixed salary to an overall package. So you have a package. So what we do is we increase everyone's package to incorporate that percentage, and then that percentage is at risk. So if a guy was on 100, we said we'll increase your salary by 10, your package by 10, not your fixed salary. We'll increase, you have a fixed salary of 100, we'll increase your package to 110, of which 10 is at risk. Because you can't take a guy's fixed salary away, he's got overhead that he needs to cover. So no one loses their fixed salary. But you have an ability. So what we're actually going on to say here is 110. If you achieve it, you get the 110. If you don't, you could lose the 70 or the 10. So I just wanted to clear that up. Just starting with Mr. Van Dijk, the issue Mr. Van Dijk, this is the first time we're meeting. I'm not a politician, so I always get nervous of having to answer on behalf of the board, particularly when the chairman's not here. I think there was some reference made to the number of boards, individual board members, and clearly I can't answer those questions. If we take the executive members, Mr. Sadiq and myself, who are executive members of executive directors, between us, I think we sit on two or three or four boards, mostly internal to the NEL. Mr. Chantal Moller, who is the audit committee chairman, which is why you find that she's virtually at every single meeting, and she also only sits on two boards. The chairman himself doesn't sit on that many boards. I can't comment on behalf of Mr. Palazzi. If one reviews Mr. Kaneni's situation, whilst he sits on 16 or 17 boards, I think about 8 or 10 of those sits within Kaneni Brothers Holdings, which are really paper companies, small companies. So it's not that he's going and attending 4 board meetings a year in massively board meetings. They're subsidiaries of subsidiaries within the holding company. I certainly have not found that any of our board members are lacking in terms of their contribution. I think we have an extremely well-balanced board. The board are making a massive contribution. The board are available very often outside of formal board meetings. I personally meet with them, Talib, as the financial director, meets with board members. We brief every board member for 2 or 3 hours before any board meeting. We are able to access our board members at any point in time. So I cannot comment further other than to say we certainly don't feel that board members are neglecting. Just in terms of the measurement of board members, we have now instituted a formal measurement scenario which has been guided by DPE in terms of an evaluation process of the board itself. And we are going through that first evaluation process right now. And I think it might be a good question to ask the chair. Our chairman is to present the findings of that evaluation of the board members themselves at a future time. But I know there is a formal process that we're going through now.
The second question was around Overberg in terms of increases. Some people are receiving 140 rand increase and others 50 to 60, 80,000 rand. I'm not aware of that at all. I can't comment. I don't know. I mean, we can ask this question. Is anyone aware of that? Do you want to comment, Yuga?
Yes, I can. I think the issue is more on the incentives that was awarded to OTD. As I mentioned earlier, when we had within this particular past financial year, we've had an interim incentive arrangement only for the executives within the place. The numbers, I obviously can't comment because I don't have it out of my head. But as I said earlier, the model that we introduced as an interim was a lesser incentive than the current model that we've introduced. It was purely to make sure that we have this transition. And in the context of OTB, they did achieve their numbers. I think they were contracted to have R1 million around their profit, and they turned around at about 6-7 million profit last year. And it was only the executives of the entity that were contracted. So far, the other increases, I would assume that would have been just the normal annual increase for the rest of the other staff within OTB.
I mean, we can get more clarity if we need to. I mean, we don't have the figures offhand. If I just go through some of the other questions, and we'll come, I'll leave all the difficult ones for Hugo, and I'll go back to you in a second. Hugo, you need to deal with the development program, the criteria for the development program, and the 25% quartile. I can answer Hendricks. We talk 25% or 75%. So we're talking 25%, which implies at the bottom level, the 25th percentile, which is at the bottom. You also referred to the board, and hopefully we will answer those questions. Hugo, you need to answer the issue on the disciplinary actions, what the situation is. The low morale issue I'd like to talk about. If we start talking about morale, and we talk about 2.5 years ago, it was at minus 10 out of 10. So low morale is a huge improvement, because from where we were, low morale is great. I don't think the morale is that low anymore. People have seen evidence, and I think for many, many years there was talk about restructuring, there was talk about equity partnerships, there was talk about performance management, there was talk about transformation, there was talk about changes in organizational structure. There is now evidence of it. It's not something which we're talking about, it's something which has happened. So people are clearly on route to understanding where we want to go and have belief and faith that we are actually doing what we said we were going to do. We've done everything we said we were going to do. I think people are still scarred. People are still nervous about exactly what's going to happen. They see the trend, they see the figures moving, but let's be honest, we still lost 500 million rand on a turnover of 3.2 billion rand. That's still a huge loss. In many parts of the business, we're reporting equity partners like the Carl Zeiss organization. We had 700 people, we retrenched 300, we were down to 400. We were going to close that company 3 to 4 months ago if we did not get them in as a partner. And you go and look at what Carl Zeiss has now done in terms of introduction of new office space, new business that brought down there, the people are pumped up. So when we talk about morale, I think we should start talking about morale in company A versus morale in company B versus in company C. Because in some of the businesses, our morale is very high. In some of the businesses, as we illustrated, we're still on the last edge. We're not sure whether we're going to make it, and we're trying to sweat that process. What we're doing about it is obviously delivering on our strategy. And if leadership actually deliver on that which they say they're going to deliver, people start having belief. So that's a huge issue in terms of what we're doing about morale. We conducted a climate survey last year for new members that weren't here previously. We conducted a climate survey to 4,300 people in the group, getting an understanding of what the issues were, what were the concerns in the company. And there were many issues, such as a lack of a performance management system, such as a lack of a world-class incentive system, lack of clarity in terms of direction, lack of communication, lack of involvement from the people. All those issues are now being addressed, and hence the morale of the company will turn. We all know that nothing breeds motivation more than success. And so as we start being more successful in the relative businesses, so you will see the morale picking up. I'm comfortable that we're addressing the correct issues there. Talib, you need to address the R&D, but no, that's Mr. Wang had that question, we'll deal with it later. The issue on the physically challenged issue, the pilot training, Excuse me? Yeah, the disciplinary actions Mr. Abu will deal with. I think those are most of the questions that I needed to answer. If I can hand over to you, you go on the rest.
Thank you, Sean. On the youth development, the question was really which areas do we get our students from? I think it's important just to understand that the youth development we are dealing with is in conjunction with the Department of Defense. They have about 80% of the students that we have within the Youth Foundation, and they do their own recruitment. The focus is on the rural areas. So the 80% of students from a DoD perspective comes from all areas within the country. Our 20% that remains that we're doing with GDE and Transnet and the other SOEs, we also focus on kids from the rural areas, Venda, Northwest Province, etc. So wherever we have a particular need or a request, we could go in there and source these students from there and bring them to our youth foundation place.
You can interact over tea a little bit more with
us. Insofar as the disciplinary action against managers are concerned, I'm not too sure whether it is a request of the statistics or whether it is a request of whether there has been incidences of that nature. We do have on a continuous basis disciplinary action, and it follows the disciplinary procedure within the organization. And in terms of PFMA, we do report it to our audit committee, and it's reported on a regular basis as far as the audit committee is concerned. Maybe just further clarity on that particular question.
You know, and I think what is required is some kind of analysis of how many cases you have, not necessarily each individual interest and so on, but how many cases, how far they've been progressing with, and how many have been resolved, what are the findings, that kind of thing. So that we have a broad sense of the annual report of where we stand year on year on these matters. So that you don't have cases, for example, standing 5 or 10 years and people are suspended until salary and those kinds of issues are being presented.
Thank you, Jen. No, I think at this moment we do not have any disciplinary cases pending within DINA. Where we do have cases, there are some cases which are out in the labor courts, but that is a labor court process on its own. And they're also far in between. I think we are out of the era 2-3 years ago where there was a large volume of similar cases of that nature within DINA. Today those are already maybe down because we're tightening on our systems and processes.
Okay. There's just the one issue of piloting.
Pilots, we do not train youngsters to become pilots, but in our DCLD training center, we have youngsters that go through either the youth program or the apprentice program, but when you're on the apprentice side, you're not going really for a pilot, you're going to be able to fix the airplane or avionics or whatever and so forth. But many of the Youth Foundation kids, when they leave us, they join the Air Force and they then take up a career insofar as pilot requirements are concerned. DINAL itself does not necessarily focus on pilots.
We're going to break for tea because tea is going to be cold. When we come back, I'm going to give an opportunity to those people who have their hands up on this issue of HR still. We give one single opportunity and then move on to the next round of questions. What I want to suggest is members, particularly if you have constituency type issues and so on, please use the time over tea to interact. And please, your team from DINAL, pay the courtesy to members to actually interact with them and not media and stuff like that, because this is still part of the session. Right? If you want to interact with the media and so on, please do it after the meeting. I'm quite happy for you to continue in this venue and do whatever interviews you would want. So let's come back in 10 minutes, please. Thank you.
Thanks for the agreement.
Good. Anybody else going once, going twice? Highest bidder. Nelson Fonda and then Mr. Pololo. And nobody else will be given an opportunity after this on the HR system.
other region.
Okay.
So on the on page 15, I hope it's on HR. I see that.
No, no, I'm
not. I see that the selling off of non-co assets was went up to 1 billion. But what I wanted to check as it relates to HR is how far did this affect employees? Did you, I mean, were you confronted with a number of retrenchments or what happened really there when the non-core assets were sold?
Okay, Mr. Gololo? No?
No, I think not.
Do you want to give Mr. Pandak your opportunity?
Okay, Mr. Pandak. Chairperson, this is actually a mixed question between finance and HR. I don't know whether I should leave it, because it will be part of my two questions when it comes to the finances, or whether I should ask it now.
If you give up your opportunity to ask questions on the finances, I'll give you an opportunity now. How's that?
I'll do it. I'll take this one. Thank you, Jay. Then I will reduce it to one on finance. Only one on finance now, the other one now. Chairperson, in the private sector, if a chief executive officer does not perform, you know, normally he's out. And if a minister does not perform, he's on the red carpet. I mean, this is the normal thing that happens. Now, taking into account that Danielle made the
actually, last when it comes to the DA, he's in the Sunday Cup. Not on the red carpet.
Yes, sir, but that is not part of this. Now, taking into account that Danielle made a loss of 549 million, as we saw there in the presentation, in the 07 financial year, and it's been said that remuneration has been agreed upon, how do Danielle explain to the taxpayer that the chief executive officer received a 3.25 million bonus as part of the total package of 7.4 million again? And what achievements can then be ascribed to his specific performance to justify this? I just want, I know there was a question also, and the answer that said you can't make it this, you can't distinguish between performances, but I mean, if there's a financial loss being made of 549 million, and on the other hand, you get a 3.25 bonus as part of the 4.7 million package, you know? Okay, this has been justified, thank you.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether, in fact, it's a question that you would want to pose here. I mean, I'm going to let people respond and so on, but it seems to me that the question should be posed both to the department, number one, and of course, the chairperson of the board as well. I'm going to let you respond as the question has been asked. I mean, I think, Mr. Pandak, we must take this up when we do engage with the chairperson of the board, which will be a bit later in the term as well. Okay? And, of course, the department. You want to respond to both the questions?
Yeah, well, the first question was on the 1 billion rand sale of non-core assets.
Mm-hmm.
We must just say, when you talk about non-core assets, in some cases it was property. Yeah. So we sold of property at Kempton Park for 600 million rand to AXA. There were no people involved in that process. There was a further sale of additional property of shopping centres, retail shopping centres and other business parks that we owned, which was another 230 or so odd million rand. No people involved in that process. And then there was a sale of smaller sort of sub-companies which were non-core. As an example, we owned a company called Addis, called something, but it sold Addis. It's like a Tupperware thing. You've all seen Addis, the plastic. That was our company, which is crazy. But we sold that company, went through a tender process. That company was sold with its people. And so a number of the businesses were in fact sold, and they were sold as going concerns, and they were taken over with the people. And so such, in terms of that, there were not numbers. There might have been the odd individual deal here.
Is that why the Tupperware prices are just shut through the roof? I can't afford a lunchbox anymore.
So in principle, that did not go with wholesale. If you looked, so in terms of that process, there was not any mass implications as far as that's concerned. The second question, which is the one from Mr. Hanleg, I think is a good question, and with, let's just refrain from using the group CEO as an example and talk about principles. Because in our organization, I also have CEOs. So I have CEOs who potentially could earn bonuses even though their businesses lose money. Fundamental principle is that if you break even last year and you make an 800 million rand profit this year, should you get a bonus? I would say yes. And I can't see the difference between losing 1.3 billion and making 500 million rand loss the next year and having a break even 1 year, 800 million profit the next year.
The difference is you call it a loss.
The only problem is you'll never employ anybody if a company is going to take 3 to 4 years to turn around. Who would work? I wouldn't work in a situation, and I'm being brutally honest. If I'm not going to earn an incentive for the job that I'm doing, I never broke the company. I'm fixing the company, and I should be incentivized fixing the company. So should my executive team be incentivized fixing the company. So there's an 800 million rand swing in profitability, positive, and that should be rewarded. Now that principle is a principle which the board have applied and supported, obviously, through the shareholder. So the principle for us is if there's an improvement in the business, you need to incentivize people. Otherwise, it will take us 3 to 4 years before anybody in that business earns an incentive. And why would somebody leave a company that's doing well, okay, where you can earn an incentive and join a company to come and fix it and earn nothing in that process? What we're trying to measure is improvement in performance. And based on that, we now have a remuneration system which looks at variable pay, which is bonuses, split in two areas. One, 70%, which is linked to the financial performance of the business. The other 30% is linked to other KPIs, such as transformation, quality of financial reporting, audit processes, etc. And that goes through a vigorous process. All of which I'm talking about is in line with international and local best practice. I think if I can also, in terms of that, I think that's the best that I can answer, and I agree that the chair and the board should answer the question. We have John Morris, who came in, unfortunately, playing with the debate. If I can introduce him, he's from DPE. Sitting under the back over there, and I think John, you wanted to make an attempt at answering that one as well.
Thanks, Sean. Apologies for being late.
I think you better find Mike.
You can squat
here. I think the runway problem is opposed to an SAA problem.
Typical of DPE.
Thank you. I just wanted to say the incentive bonus of Mr. Liebenberg, probably not fair to discuss the individual particular package here. I don't think it's right for him, as the chair indicated. It's in line with the performance agreement that is signed between the minister and Mr. Liebenberg, and is based on implementation of the turnaround strategy, reduction of loss, which is measured, and we all know it's going to take time to turn the ship around. Thank you.
No, that's fine. I don't think it takes the matter much further. As I said, it's a subject of discussion that we will have to have with the department as well, and of course, when the board chairperson arrives at some stage. And it's something I think we put on the back burner. It's not something that applies only to Danielle, of course. It spans across the board as far as SOEs are concerned. And what the principles are that get applied in regard to these negotiations. So it's something I imagine that we're not going to even resolve at any point in the future. But clearly, I think one of the things that the Portfolio Committee will have to do is to fine-tune its position on some of these matters and what are the bottom lines so far as pertains to what politically one would regard as acceptable or not. But that is a subject for a later discussion as well. Let's move on now to the financial issues. The matter pertaining to, now I don't know, we've got slides here, of course, that have been reduced in number from the one that you've posted up here. So the pages are all funny, but and I was going to want to point members to the slide numbers. I think on yours it was 51 to 54. I'm not sure what it is. also 51.
I can find it.
It starts from page 51 on the slide.
Page 51.
Yeah. Let me from the chair just start on some of these issues. I'm not sure if it's Mr. Talib, is it? The issue of the operating costs, you did deal with it in your submission and the presentation where you mentioned that there's actually a decrease and not necessarily a small increase that the figures speak. And perhaps you want to give us some sense of the one-off type of issues that you were speaking to, so that we have some sense of exactly what you're talking about when you say that there will be one-off costs. Secondly, in terms of your current liabilities on your balance sheet, it's on page 39 of the annual report at any rate. It seems to me that your current liabilities are up by a third. Now, I'm not sure, this may just be matters that can be explained in terms of how you or your accounting system and so on, but it does seem to me to be a matter that should be addressed. You are showing the 1.9 billion, is that how I read? The 1.9 billion in 2006, and it's up to 2.9 billion, almost 3 billion in 2007. So that's something that I think you need to deal with. And that's just on the issue of finances. But one related question, perhaps it's a bit of a straddling question as well, is your litigation, your potential litigation. The impact that has going forward on your bottom line. I see in your annual report there's some, almost a disclaimer saying that people are quite satisfied that these claims will not materialize. On what is that based? And are there question marks, to put it crudely, on one or two cases that worry you financially going forward? Members, Mr. Van Dijk? Okay. Mr. Kowani? Mr. Hendrickson? Let me just see other members. Okay, that will be the extent of the people that I've recognized to ask questions on the finance garden. Too late. Mr. Van Dijk, you can get your one question.
1 hour.
It's payback time. No, go ahead. I've got three people for time.
Chief, that's okay. So maybe there might be follow-ups of the... Chairperson, thank you. If we just look at the financial position according to the report, and you compare it with the previous financial year as well, the NEL got from Treasury allocation in 2006 a 2 billion rand, and then made a loss of 1.4 billion. In 2007, at present, the report that we dealt with, they received 467 million and 549 million loss. For next year, according to the MTF, treasury allocation is 933 million and another 222 million as a special adjustment that you dealt with a short while ago in Parliament with a bill. Now, Danielle also won a contract, as we heard, of another 8 billion from Arms Corps for Project Hoefeister, and I may say in the absence of a conventional threat, but leave it as it is. Now, what my question boils down to, Chairperson, is how can the Chief Executive Office say, when he spoke in the beginning, and I quote, he said, there is no company in the world that can do what Danel does. Now, taking that into account,
How do you explain then the financial position and performance that is actually poor? You should be actually, if you said that, then be a leading company in the world. Can you just elaborate on that? Thank you.
Okay, good. Who did I have next? I had two.
Thanks, Chair. Mine will be short. I'm just reminded here that the other one is already passed. So, Chair, I wanted to get an understanding on the supply chain within Guinea. There is an indication that your companies which are going to be delisted. I just want to check the coordination of that. On page 30 of the annual report, there is an indication that Guinea will continue to verify the shares of companies and delist some of those companies. I just want to check that that has been done in consultation with DPE and the other SOEs, so that you don't believe the company is passed, but it appears on DISCOM still getting procurement and so on. The second one, Chair, is around the issue of the gearing ratio. Where are we in the current around that particular matter? I've not yet picked it up on the report, the gearing ratio, which links to your liabilities and so on. Where are we currently? Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Anderson?
Mine is with regard to the annual report, page 108. It's with the Dell Supplementary Provident Fund. And I'm not quite sure. You say there that this is a defined contribution plan, but you show the company getting surplus funds. And my understanding is that all money is paid into a defined contribution fund belongs to the employees. How come it is that the employee is getting surplus funds?
That it? Okay, then Mr. Kololo gets the chance.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine will be on procurement, supply chain. In fact, I just wanted to get a comment from the Dinel team here, from the Chief Executive Officer, as to what will be his comment on the broad black, what's that? The triple B, double E, procurement, is he on the decline from 22% black economic procurement to 18.6%, which was caused by verification processes, which exposed several fronts for the white businesses masquerading as PEE. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's get some answers to those.
Okay, I will answer a few and then hand over some to my colleagues. Starting with the question on litigation, we as an executive team manage the total litigation risk extensively and formally on a monthly basis, in which the schedule there will be claims are there. In terms of the swings and balances, we believe that we have sufficient provisions as a total provision base. And we manage the issue very closely and also getting input from external legal advisors. So from our perspective, Chair, the question was, do we have sufficient provision? Do we feel we're at risk? No, we don't. We feel we have sufficient provisions in place.
So where is that reflected, sir? In your balance sheet? So where are those in your financials?
It should be reflected in the current liabilities if there are possible claims against the now.
Okay.
So hopefully that answers that one. The question that I would like to deal with mostly is the question by Mr. van Dijk. Why have we received recapitalization of 3.5 billion rand and we do all the things that we can do of losing money? The recapitalization of 3.5 billion rand fundamentally has been used to pay off the debts of the past. So if we look at the business and the debts within the organization and the loans that the organization had, we needed what we called, and if we go back to the recapitalization proposal and discussions we had with this particular committee at the time, We divided the total recapitalization request into two parts. One which we called the sins of the past. In other words, how do we clear up and create a neutral balance sheet on which we can move forward? And secondly, what do we need to do and how much money do we need to invest into the future in terms of restructuring, R&D, etc., etc.? So if one reflects on the capital investment and the capital injection that's been made, that has no significance as far as the income statement will be concerned, because the capital that came in fundamentally went into sorting out the balance sheet, which is what we've done. So all those eight businesses now, the debts and the loans were paid off, and the business is standard, and all the legacy issues are sorted out. We took out 2,500 people over the period. And that is all part of the restructuring process for which the recapitalization has been used. The reason the NEL runs at a loss annually is because we have a fixed cost base at a certain level and our sales aren't at the right level to fix it. So we have to fix sales. The recapitalization has no impact whatsoever on the annual operating profit of the company. On that basis, you saw, and we showed you the slide, that for the last 10 years the NEL has lost money annually. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of rands, which eroded the balance sheet. So the recap was to put the balance sheet back into place. What we now need to do is to operate the company effectively and efficiently relative to the cost base. In many instances, we don't have the money to do restructuring. So we might have to spend a couple of hundred million rand to re-engineer a particular company. We don't have the money for that, so we find an equity partner who can come and help us and inject that money on the one hand. Secondly, we need to raise the sales in the organization, which is what we're doing. Hence, we moved from a 1.3 billion loss to a 550 million loss. But the sales are not yet at the correct level. In many other instances, why are we running at a loss? We have a billion rand or 3 billion rand on which we're making no margin. Because contracts which were signed 6, 7, 8 years ago are at negative margins. So if you take a billion rand or 3 billion and those are at negative margin, there's nothing you can do about it. Those are contracts which you have to wash off the system. So it will continue to make net losses, operating net losses in the business, until such time as the margin on the business that you are achieving is sufficient to give you the necessary return. Two things: efficiency, productivity, to raise the gross profit margin, and increase in sales to cover the overheads. Which is why you see those slides where we demonstrate what the break-even is. Our munitions company is a prime example. We have a 1.2 billion rand break even in that company. Unless we achieve sales of 1.2 billion, we can't operate profitably. How are we going to do that? We propose an equity partnership, which the board has approved. It's going to help to bring us revenue and going to help us to improve our gross profit. And we're fighting every day. I'll use the word cautiously, not fighting, negotiating with the Department of Defense, with National Treasury, to ensure that we get visibility of a future spend, so that we have certainty on the revenue lines so that we can run at a profitable level. So the recap and the operating profit are completely divorced from one another. We're running at a loss traditionally because we don't have sufficient sales to cover our overheads. We need to improve sales and reduce costs through the introduction of equity partnerships and better efficiencies in the business.
Can I ask this question? Look, I mean, you've said that you've done this in the past and you've gone through this exercise in the past with the committee, and clearly the members here would know more about it than I would, because I'm like all of 2 weeks old. But perhaps what you could do is, in line with the question that Mr. van Dijk poses in terms of the NTA going forward, to give us those projections as far as the recap is concerned, and then give us a sense in a report, not a very long report, and not necessarily, you know, something that is going to take you too much time, but to give us just a sense of how, if there are legacy issues, how much of that goes to legacy issues, how much you project going to legacy issues going forward. If there are real recap projects that you're busy with in terms of your restructuring of entities and so on, how much is project going into those districts, so that we have almost a global picture around the entire recap issue for the NEL going forward.
Chair, we obviously had detailed this in the past. I think just to reflect for a minute, is when we started this exercise, there was a lot of call, people saying close the company down, etc. We believed and we knew that certain parts of the business were really healthy. The problem is you couldn't see it because it was in this big company. Now that we split some of it out, for instance, our company, Mechem, had a turnover last year of 170 million rand. It made 40 million rand net profit. Why should we close it down? But the call was to close it down because you couldn't see it. Now that we split them out, we see there are some businesses which are really healthy. And we can focus on those which are not healthy to try and fix them. If we can't fix them, can we find a partner who can fix it? And if we can't find a partner, can we close it? That is the process. We must remind the committee that we also gave the shareholder the option at the time to close the meltdown at a fee of somewhere between 16 and 18 billion rand. That was the choice. We said we can close it down. These are the implications, these are the costs. If we want to keep the capability because it's a strategic asset, which we've been told it is, then we need to look at spending around about 3.5 to 5 billion rand investing in various, getting rid of the legacy contractual issues, the legacy debts, for instance, the optronics company where we had to pay up a lot of debts, create a neutral balance sheet, and then find a partner who can take it forward. So the shareholder then made the call to say, let's spend the 3.5 to 5 billion rand. Let's go through the process and the strategy you proposed. And let's work towards taking the good businesses out, and then let's see what remains and see how we deal with it. And we can clearly articulate the details. DPE work with us. We report monthly to DPE. We report quarterly to Treasury on every single aspect of our recapitalization and our turnaround plan in terms of the rand and cents. So we certainly can articulate this for this committee.
No, thanks a lot. And I think it's probably going to be more for my edification than the members. I think members are fairly on board on these issues. So thank you for that. Please proceed to the next one. Mr. Paul, one is supply chain.
Sure, Chair, you had asked some questions as well, which I'd like to respond. And if you'd allow me, perhaps I could respond to the question that was asked during the HR time around research and development. And that relates to page 52 of our annual report, relates to how much of money we are at the moment spending on research and development. As a percentage of sales, for the year to date, up to the end of September, we have spent 1.5% of, this is Danel-funded research and development. What this excludes is client-funded research and development. We felt that it's a better measure to look at the total amount of money that we spend on research and development.
But that would be all of your entities together, or is there a separate R&D entity that you have?
It's research and development is decentralized in each of the entities, and that's been our strategy that we've adopted, moving away from a centralized approach to a decentralized approach, and it's aligned with the market needs for that specific product. And if one has to compare like with like, in our director's report under the KPIs, the contracted amount of research and development was 3% of sales, and this only related to the now funded research and development. We felt that that was not a good measure, and we had to include client funded. Taking into account client funded research and development, you find that we've spent 13.6% of our revenue on research and development in total. If you had to compare like with like, if you had to look at what the now funded research and development for the March 2007 year was, that was 2.5% against 3% that was contracted. So you can see, as part of the turnaround phase, and it's a position that we are not pleased with, we are in fact sacrificing a bit on our research and development costs as well. But we are moving it to client-funded research and development. That's the strategy we've adopted. In terms of your question around once-off costs, the once-off costs that we've included in our operating costs relates to some of the issues around litigation. We have made further provisions where we felt that we were exposed, and based on discussions that we've had with the auditors and our audit committee, we felt that we needed to up our provision relating to, I think this is public knowledge, it's relating to the discussions we're having with India, where we are in an arbitration process. The other once-off adjustment we had to make is to an export debtor of ours, an export customer. We are currently in discussions with this export customer. Because there are certain legal issues that are outstanding, we've made a provision for that particular customer. And for commercial reasons, we cannot disclose further details around that. And then the last once-off adjustment we had to make dealt with land restoration. We are currently, we had to make a provision for remediation work, and it's a a big part of the provision relates to land and space in the Western Cape. We've taken a strategic decision to consolidate our operations into one facility, and with that move, we then had to create a provision for restoration costs on the land that's going to be vacant in preparation to sell off this land. The next question you had was on the growth in current liabilities. The increase in current liabilities are about R1 billion. A big portion of that relates to the reclassification of the corporate bond. In the previous year, that corporate bond was disclosed as long non-current liabilities, and you would see that of R2 billion. And you will see that that has decreased in the March 2007 year. We in fact repaid the corporate bond in August, middle of August this year, and hence we have to classify as a current liability.
The other one.
Okay, moving on then, on to the next question, really. Could I continue, Chair?
Yes.
Dealing with the gearing ratio, if you look at page 38 of our annual report, and you will find details of key ratios, and on page 38 we have the debt equity ratio that's disclosed, and you will see it's 1.3 times. And if you look at above page 38, dealing with the balance sheet, you will see that our interest borrowings total R832 million against an equity position of R633 million, and hence you get to the ratio of 1.3. On the issue of the Provident Fund, which is on page 108 of the annual report, this Provident Fund was created as a retention scheme for select employees going back to the former Danal period. And this was not a pension fund. So although it operated to an extent as a contribution fund, the remaining members at that stage, it was a benefit fund linked in with their salary. Those liabilities were then paid out to them, and the residue, it was a Danal created fund for these select employees, and the residue could not be distributed to any of the members because it was linked to their salaries. Once that liability was then paid off, the balance has to accrue to Danal. And
that part was a defined benefit.
Yeah.
I apologize for that.
Okay. Moving on then, onto the MTF going forward. This is something that we would work on. In our cash flow statement, we have disclosed to you the cash that we've received from our shareholder, which is on page 62 of the annual report. If you look at it, we clearly disclose the amount of money that we've received from the shareholder, and Sean in his response to your question did answer briefly, and it's just a correction. We did not receive 467 over the past year, but 567 million, and you will see that on page 62, and you will see that we've used it in the operations as outlined on the cash flow statement. But we will follow this up with a report going forward as well.
Good.
I trust I've answered those particular questions adequately. Oh, sorry, the other question dealt with the BBBE around procurement, and we currently have an initiative in process right now where we are establishing standards around broad-based black empowerment, and we are doing this in discussions with the Department of Public Enterprises. A lot of work has gone through at the department, and this initiative would also be applicable to the other state-owned entities as well. I would, Sean, if it's fine, if patients could add on some of the initiatives that we've undertaken.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think just to maybe indicate that the eight elements of transformation, as my colleague Hugh already indicated, include BBBE. We are currently in a process of what we call a diagnostic assessment to see whether we comply with the conditions of the Code of Good Practice. We're not where we would like to be yet because the process is only just resumed. What we would like to concentrate on, obviously, is the area of supplier development and preferential procurement, because that's basically where historically disadvantaged communities or individuals we find it difficult to enter. So
We would like to see BBBE go forward and beyond compliance. So if I can just report that we are, as I said, we are at a stage where we, with each of the entities, looking at where they are, because Sean has already indicated that we run very different business units with different types of business models. So we cannot basically treat them the same. That is why we need to understand some of our entities have 90% spend overseas and not locally, and others the other way around. So we cannot just use systems and processes that would reach across the board. So I think if I'm answering the question correctly, we are looking at BBBE and we're looking at compliance of our own, but also to assist our suppliers to develop them.
I wonder if part of your strategy doesn't include an outreach, in the sense that, you know, procurement by its very nature is a passive kind of exercise. We would issue a procurement notice of some sort and we'd wait for whatever offers come. And in this instance, doesn't it really require, given the historic environment that we're having to deal with, given the fact that a lot, there may be suppliers out there who just historically have no links with the now colleges and so on, whether in fact there isn't some kind of outreach and that kind of element. I'm not quite sure myself how one would do it, but it does seem to me that part of the problem in this kind of environment is that you tend to get used to certain suppliers, and you then deal with them, and you assist them, and so on. But it actually doesn't deal with your historic legacy in Japan. So maybe if you want to speak to your own because you don't like this.
Okay, maybe just a comment to say, once we do understand exactly where we are, we would be able to draw up strategies for each of the entities, which will take into consideration what actions and interventions we need to embark on. Specifically, I mean, taking into account what you just said. We do recognize that it's not an area predominantly littered by previously disadvantaged individuals, and so we have to make extra effort. And not only in the areas of commercial goods and services, you know, your stationery and all of that. We need to move into the real areas of the business. So,
sure. Just to add on that, you would have noticed when we show you a slide on procurement, we had stated on that slide plan B spend, because it's for certain services we've taken a concrete decision to say our priority should be to, at that stage it was a definition of BEU spend. And so on that basis we've tracked our performance. The reason why the BEU spend was lower than the total spend is because of our foreign-based OEM supplies that we are forced to deal with. But we do follow a very transparent process around our procurement. You make a very valid point that we would err to the side of using suppliers that we've used before, and that's something that we are driving across the entities to ensure that we do comply with the PFMA and the transparent and public process is followed, giving everyone the opportunity.
Okay. Rich, was there a follow-up, Mr. Bolora?
Yeah, there is a follow-up, but it's not the question that they asked. In fact, the question that they asked, actually, I wanted to comment on the verification processes which exposed several fronts of white businesses who were masquerading as BEE companies. I just wanted to find out as to did you address that problem, because there was a problem earlier on, if you remember, in your last annual report of 2006, that there were so many of these white companies that were masquerading as a black company. So I just wanted to get that one, as to where are they in addressing that problem.
Yeah, we have addressed the problem through a very strict verification process. We did have some problems with verification agencies themselves in many instances. We now have an initiative working with DPE once again, where there's a centralized approach to how we deal with verification. So we've cleaned up that situation. We have also changed a lot of the
people and structure within our supply chain environment that has changed recently, and we put it into another area of discipline. The fact that we decentralize means that we can actually have a clearer look at where we can actually proactively benefit the procurement relative to us being in a reactive situation previously. So I think if you look at where it was at 22%, went to 18%, went back up to 21%, we far exceeded the target we set ourselves for last year, and we will continue to exceed our targets as we go forward. So I think for the most, I think to say that we've totally cleared up the situation would be incorrect. We continue to work at it and scrutinize it in terms of our governance process as we go forward.
Okay. That's the project I'm
asking.
You have one more finance question?
Yes, Chair. Chair, thank you. This was part of the presentation. I just want to know, taking into account that there is at present no conventional threat, is the CEO of the opinion that the replacement of the Rattle with a new 264 vehicles is really necessary at this stage, or is that 8 billion just another way to come to the rescue of the Nell?
Necessary for who?
We're waiting for the war to come
to it. Now, I'm trying to get clarity on the question, so I understand.
That's my question. That's what I want to know exactly. Is it really
necessary for who, Mr. Kalaji?
For the country. Because they want a contract for that, and I want to.
Yeah, but they don't order it. It's somebody else who orders it.
That's why RTC really, does he think it is really necessary? I just want to get his opinion.
So what you're saying is, if he thinks that it's not necessary for his client, he shouldn't make it.
Well, they are the manufacturers of arms equipment.
Can I take a stab at it, and I'm going to say that firstly, again, I'm not the army. I don't decide what I need, and we also just soldiers. We get asked to do something, we do it. But I think there's a broader thing here, and that is that you can't wait until the threat occurs. This is philosophy, military philosophy. You can't wait until the threat occurs and says, now all of a sudden we need a modern vehicle. It takes 10, 15, 20 years from the date of the initial planning of a new platform to implement that platform in a particular country. So if a threat had to occur 12 months, 24 months from today, you can imagine the outcry from the population that we are not equipped. Okay, so you have to plan these things in advance. And these things take a long time. You see that this project runs to 2018. It started 5 years ago. And it runs to 2018. That means it's a 16-year plan. And you have to plan in advance. I can't comment on the military strategy and the force requirements, etc. All I know is that from a defense procurement point of view, projects take very, very long. The Gripen that you ordered, I think the same question is, do we need a Gripen? Do we need 28 fighter aircraft? That project started in 1980. And those aircraft will be delivered in the next 2 to 3 years. That's a 30-year project. So you have to plan equipment long in advance because of the complexity.
I think that's the real problem for me, just kind of at a high level, is that the past-year strategy seems to be going in on the domestic market, and essentially we're talking about the Department of Defense and Arms Corps essentially as clients. And the concern for me would be at a strategic level, whether in fact those sources actually translate to a significant market going forward. I mean, you have certain benchmarks to meet and so on in terms of your revenue generation. And for me, it would be just a concern that if that is the strategy, is that a sufficient client base?
Yes, the answer is absolutely it is not. Which is why our strategy says you either keep a capability in a country or you share the burden of that capability with equity partners. So if you take Carl Zeiss and their introduction to the company, it got to a point where we're going to close the business. Then you lose that capability forever, and it is world-class capability. Alternatively, you bring a credible partner in from a foreign affairs point of view, credible, from a technology point of view, a leader across the world. They own 70% of the burden, we own 30%, but it's a South African company with South African people, so you keep that capability. And you're 100% right. The local market will never fund Danel, which is why this whole process that we've been following, our strategy of finding international partners that can help us, is being fundamental. If we cannot have those international partners, in many instances we cannot retain the business. And it's reflected again in that munitions business that we showed you. They have a break-even of $1.2 billion. We need to spend $500 million to restructure if we don't have the money. And we need huge increases in revenue. Now, either the government of South Africa funds it 100% themselves, or they find a credible partner that can work with us and keep that capability. Or we use the capability. Those are the choices. And we have driven the strategy of finding those equity partners who can bring the investment and help us to fund it. You're 100% right. We will never fund the industry locally. We cannot.
Okay. Because you've been so good and not asked a single question, I'm going to give you one opportunity. We have to now move on. We're already at 25 to 1, according to you.
Now, I hope I'm not going to spoil the tension, but the position has been that...
How likely is that?
My question is basically more on the general side, but since Mr. van Dijk has moved into that specific area, which was actually covering the two aspects, it's also indirectly, maybe, could be linked to what he has said. But it is common knowledge that, you know, that the peacekeeping operations in South Africa is a major event, particularly as far as Africa is concerned. And we have noticed that we have failed to a certain extent to obtain the maximum rentals which we could have obtained from the EU and the and basically those funding that could be available for vehicles because of our military vehicles being, you could almost say, being, I would almost say 60% of them being out of order in the DRC and down those particular areas. Now, I would take it that this particular Hoefeister and the Badger infantry would, whether that would suffice in terms of the replacing of certain of the vehicles that are being presently being used over there. I don't want to interfere or to link on to the defense question so much, but the matter which was reported simply was that the maintenance capability of DOD in this particular aspect has been, I will be politically correct and I would call it a challenge, but it was actually in fact a failure. Whether in terms of that with the Danel, with Danel's setup with regard to the South African Air Force, where similar type of aspects are being negotiated, that you have a more crystal clear, you could almost say, maintenance aspect. Now specifically with regard to the Badger infantry fighting vehicles, that the maintenance with regard to that, my question is more, will Danel be the maintenance supplier there, or will it be passed over to DOD, and that DOD will mainly do that? I know it's a bit of a long-winded question, but it is interrelated in terms of that particular aspect.
Let me ask you to just note that question. I'm going to open up for the general aspects as well. Because we seem to be veering into that area in any case. You might want to also add to that question the comment that you made about the Roy. the comment that you made about you're not quite sure how maintaining and so on is going to happen in the future, is that because you're closing down that project, or what exactly is the problem? And from your comment, clearly there needs to be some explanation about that. Mr. Polwani, you've got your hand up.
Mine, I think the CEO has tried to the group that you understand there are many but the group of the Chief Makumba. Chair, my question is just around the issue. I think the CEO did mention it. That the success of Dinel will lie mostly in terms of the cooperation of the other stakeholders, including DOD, AMCO, and so on. Because I think on their last report, one of the issues was highlighted was that there is no cooperation. I'm sure it also indicated that there's a lot of duplication in other instances. I just want to get this assessment around that particular matter. I hope it's not a good comment. It's well within him. That is there any progress around that? I'm just very checked because we continue to say if we seek to listen to become a success, then we will. Just in his assessment, whether I will move forward in terms of that cooperation within the various stakeholders. So that we can be short, maybe ourselves. Because we remember that the finance, the other part of finance came to us, they were not dealing with the infra call and so on, to say, we're having not in end, and your SAA, they want money. Once you schedule, they're not scheduling 2 and so on, why don't you put them to schedule 3B and so on?
No, the typical one, I remember perfectly.
So, sorry, Chairman, my apologies. I forgotten that the kind of leadership. But I just want to get your overview comment around the issue of cooperation and so on. And what can we do?
And might I just add that next time you want to call somebody, I'm a Kuru Bas, you look in my direction. Mr. White, Mr. Wang in there.
Next year, I think my question is, depending on how good the relationship is the chief information officer with the group. So I don't know if the CEO can answer this, maybe at a later stage. But as far as I know, Carlton Creek thought that the Nile group, or maybe just the holding company or one of the companies, has now decided to go ahead with the procurement of a new ERP system, Musik or Musik, I don't know what the name of it, apparently it's a specialist ERP system with on the industry. So my question is, prior that, the now particularly the aerospace, the now aerospace was using SAP R2, release 2 system, I know it's old system, I've confirmed with SAP Sciatica as well, they said the now is definitely licensed for SAP R3, which is the newer system. Now, what is the reason of a switch in the ERP system, given the ERP system is quite integral, quite important to the integration of various groups and also integration with other systems? And at the same time, while the ministry is trying to create a cooperation between various SOEs, I think SA is running SAP R2 still, and others, I don't know what other SOEs are doing, but this impact of going to other brand of ERP system, what impact does it have, and how does this improve, if any, to the NAS overall strategy in terms of more effective and more efficient operation?
Okay, what's the ERP system?
The ERP what ERP is integration of various modules, and we actually integrate all your functionalities. Electronic is basically more efficient and supply chain.
Computer.
It's a computer system. Yes.
Did you say it's the thingy that flashes in front of me? Mr. Nagul.
Yes, I'm just trying to ask what the corona was asking. From last year, this question of cooperation with the other stakeholders, which was also highlighted, but from another context when it was identified when you consider domestic market, and then now we see at the area of planning for the demand to plan for the future, they need the input from the stakeholders at school and so, but now I would like to get an answer to what is the progress exactly of organizing an official forum? Is this attempt that is the highest level. This is why sometimes we need the UNICEF to get involved, or the consultants with the graduate department that we are working with this year. We do help for the forums of the DGs and the research staff, and they help for the commonly related activities. But now with this one, what is the problem? Because we did talk about it last year and one thing that is necessary for this world for continental plan for future activities, for the needs then.
We have not contracted any responsibility for the maintenance of Rufeta at this point in time. I do agree that there needs to be a better planning process as far as that's concerned, but we haven't even started planning on Rufeta in terms of the maintenance and how we look after that. So I can't comment further. On Woyfolk, in terms of that, just the explanation is that Denel is a design authority. We have been tasked to design, commission and deploy and commission 12 aircraft. That process will be finished in 3 years' time. Because there's only 12 aircraft going into the future, if something needs to be redesigned or redeveloped, you have to go and create capital and funding to do that, because there is no provision for further obsolescence and redundancy of those 12 aircraft. If you have 500 or 1,000 aircraft, then that gets amortized over the total volume. And there's a total forward plan on the maintenance, obsolescence and redundancy of the components within the aircraft. We do not have visibility of that plan, and maybe we don't need to. We are purely the supplier of the aircraft. The question we are asking is anybody planning for that? Because I don't want it to come back to Denel at some point in time and say, no, there's something that now has to be redesigned, and where's the funding? And we've raised this with the shareholder, and the shareholder is looking at that. The shareholder or the owner of the aircraft being asked for on the staff. We're just raising it as an issue that we will continue to support the aircraft, to deploy and commission it. Thereafter, we do not have access to how that aircraft gets looked after, and it's a shareholder issue which is being addressed. And that's all we're raising as far as that issue is concerned. If we go into the cooperation issue, and I think there were two members here that asked similar questions about the cooperation. I did say that our sense was that we've moved from north out of 10, and it was literally negative. It wasn't even north out of 10. The relationship between the relative parties was non-existent. The Denel executive did not talk to the on-school executive. On-school executive did not talk to the DOD. That issue is gone. We are talking continuously, daily, at all levels. We have DPE fully involved in that process, and we have constructed the base. We've moved from north out of 10 to 5 or 6 out of 10. The issue still abounds as to what is strategic. So if you go and ask the Chief of the Army what is strategic, or the Procurement Director, or the DOD, or Arms Corps, what is strategic for the country? They have, in their own ranks, 10 different views as to what is strategic. And Denel has a different view as to what is strategic. And that is going to prevent, in our view, this from going from 0 out of 10 to 10 out of 10. We're almost there. Now, during the course of the time, there's a number of parallel processes that are taking place. One is the redrafting of the white paper of defense, which is in the process. The second one is the defense strategy in terms of the force size and the role of the force in terms of the AU and the peacekeeping missions. There's a whole plan around that. And the third issue was a South African defense-related industry study which was conducted in consultation with all the stakeholders, the report of which is now available, or not available, concluded. In terms of the conclusion of that document, there does not seem to be harmony as to the interpretation of that document in terms of where we go. And that implicates the high-level strategic imperative. which again impacts the mandate that the NAM has got. So somebody might say missiles is strategic for the country, someone else says it's not. And Danel is the supplier that's in the middle, and then your budgeting process either follows the one view that missiles is strategic or is not. So the question really relates around fine-tuning at the highest possible level, and it is being debated at that level. From what I understand, the cabinet memo will emanate from this process. We have a slight frustration, and I say that guardedly, that this process is taking long while we have a commercial entity to run and we're waiting for these strategic imperatives to come through. So on the ground level, huge interaction, albeit that many of the discussions are robust, I think we're coming up with conclusions and solutions in driving the entities forward. There are a number of strategic decisions which are still outstanding in which the key stakeholders do not have synergies in the sentiment, and that will implicate the rate at which the total sustainability of the NAM is developed. It is, I can't remember, Stendix, I think you asked the question, I wasn't quite sure. It is verging now on going into more of a political discussion, Chair, and we are not politicians, we're very simple people. The next question was the question by Mr. Wang. We don't currently have a Chief Information Officer. We're busy restructuring our entire views towards the whole IT environment. There's a long legacy. Just going back, our businesses fundamentally did incorporate SAP through most of the business. A number of years ago, if one goes through the board issues, there was a decision made to take SAP out of the businesses, I'm talking now 4 or 5 years ago, and to implement a new ERP system called QMusic, which was developed in a company co-owned by Danel at the time, a company called CoSource. Danel owned 51% or 57%. We developed QMusic, stripped SAP out, put QMusic in, and that's where certain problems occurred. In many instances, the environment in which QMusic is implemented is practically possible. In other areas, it's not. So we're stripping QMusic out of certain businesses again and putting SAP in. What we are doing at a corporate level, though, is creating an integration tool. We're busy with a study there to create an IT integration consolidation capability, which will be able to pull from the different systems we've got. Again, the process of decentralizing the business means that we have a small business, for instance, 30 people, small revenue, we can put an off-the-shelf ERP system in there, like an ACTAC or something, to make sense for that business. It doesn't make sense going to SAP. In another business, we have to make alternative arrangements. So we are in that process at the moment of redeveloping the total IT strategy.
What does that mean? He understood every word you said. But does it mean that your systems speak to each other?
At the moment, they don't speak to each other. But the question we've got to ask is, they don't need you. Because when we sold the company to Carl Zeiss, that system that's sitting in that Carl Zeiss subsidiary now or associate company doesn't need to speak to my head office. We don't need the individual businesses to be able to talk to each other because they're separate PTY limited, so many with different shareholders. So what we need to do is to put a system in place in each business that suits that business. Then at the top, we put an IT capability and they can pull information from each of those so that Talib and his team can assess the financial information. And you have
a more cost-effective way of doing it than just installing a system that speaks to each other to begin with.
It would cost hundreds of millions, so it is the most efficient way. But IT, let's not fool anybody, has been a problem for us. Information flow has been a problem, and legacy decisions has implicated the fact that we had a fairly dismal situation 2 years ago, which we're working on rectifying.
Okay, I think that's done it, yes. Okay. In the last few minutes that we have, could we maybe just go through on page 50 of your annual report, your KPIs. I detailed them, but particularly I'm looking at your measurable indicators. Somebody wants to just take us through some of those issues. I see some of them you've managed to achieve, some of them you haven't, or many of them you haven't. Give us a sense of where we are and what the sense is going forward on each of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 measurable indicators.
Thank you, Chair. I'll take that question.
Okay.
Chair, these measurable indicators were basically derived from our strategy. And what we did is we told the Department of Public Enterprises what we were going to do, and then they embodied those measurable indicators into the Shareholders' Compact, and now we are measured against each of those individual indicators. So if you look through the first four, what Danelle's non-core businesses actually contributed in terms of its loss by about R1 billion, and that was part of the money that was spent on recapitalization to refund those losses. So one of the things we had to do was focus on our core business and divest of all of our non-core disposals. So we told the Department of Public Enterprises what we would do, how many we would dispose of. They put that into a contracted position in our Shareholders Compact, and the achieved position is what we achieved during the year under review. I don't know if you want me to go through each of the individual KPIs.
I do.
Okay. In terms of sales, again, one of the issues that we identified as a problem with our audit coverage, the group CEO covered that in the presentation. And our audit coverage, as we said at the start of the year, was 35%. We agreed with the department that we would try to get to 69%. And as of 31st of March, we did not achieve that. But we have since then made significant efforts, and we have improved that. So it was 75% within a month of the year end. In terms of cost reductions, one of our main issues was that our employee to turnover ratio was too low. And again, in defense industry, the benchmark ratio is actually R1 million per head. What we were saying is that our legacy issues are so large that we cannot get to R1 million per head in a turnaround of 1 year. So we have an iterative process, and by the time we have turned another round in 3 years' time, we would expect by growing turnover that we would be in that position. Improvements of governance and risk management policies and systems. This was a major area for us. Our internal controls were very, very poor when this management team came in. For example, we did things like employing PricewaterhouseCoopers to take on our internal control. We are in the process of employing KPMG to assist us with compliance. And we have significantly improved our financial capability by employing chartered accountants in the business. The rest of the committee will be aware that at the time that we took over, there was one chartered accountant in the business. We now have somewhere between 12 and 15. We have significantly improved all of our processes across the board. As far as compliance with legislation is concerned, there were instances of non-compliance, but none of them were serious. But that doesn't mean that that they're acceptable. So what we have now done is we have made sure that each of the individual businesses does comply with the PFMA and other relevant legislation. In the defense industry, there are a number of regulatory issues that you need to comply with. And what we have also done is, it's one of the functions of Danelle Corporate, where we believe that compliance of Danelle and its subsidiaries must be a corporate function, and that's why we're paying attention to it in this financial year.
I think what you need to do is, you see, I can read this stuff, and I can see how far you've managed to get in this financial year. But very similar to what you've done on the sales, where you start saying to me, going forward, we're looking at already 75% from a month after the year ends. There needs to be some sense of, for example, in the 5 non-core properties that are at an advanced stage, when we need some sense from you, you may not necessarily call it the formal target, but we need some sense from you how long you think that's going to take going forward. Likewise, the issue of your cost reduction, you seem to indicate that it's dependent on your revenue being generated. Yes, that's one aspect of it, but you've listed it under cost reduction. So what costs are we looking at? Does that have implications in terms of retrenchment?
what are those implications, what are the timelines for doing. So a lot more detail then needs to be forthcoming on that one. But I don't know that we have, and if you want to respond, I think we should do that. But perhaps we can have it in written form from you, just so that we have a think come next year in terms of the very these indicators, exactly how far you've managed to achieve, and we won't necessarily call them new targets, because clearly you will need to redefine those for yourself at a later stage. But it gives us a sense moving forward from now till then, where it is you expect to be.
Sure, if I may. We also have a corporate plan which gives a 3-year forecast. The problem with an annual report is it's looking at the history.
Yeah.
And this is also a public document. We don't necessarily make our corporate plan public. But what we usually also have with you is a strategy session. And during the strategy session, what we do is we tell you what our forecasts are going forward, where we expect to be, and which strategy initiatives we're driving in order to achieve the results that we're trying to achieve. So we're very happy to do that, and we can prepare a paper in that regard without any problem at all.
I think just on these measurable indicators at this stage, because clearly one of the things that we're doing now is to measure the key performance indicators and to measure you against those key performance indicators. But we can't say in our report that you failed to meet your key performance indicators if in fact you have plans going forward, and that doesn't give a holistic picture. So I think that's really what I'm saying. And then the second thing is, I'm not sure when you have your strategic engagement with this committee. Maybe you can tell me. But from what I learned yesterday, apparently we don't see you in the first half of next year at all. If that's the case, then that's what I know. But if not, you can just invite me.
Sure, I'm not responsible for your program. In the past, what has happened is that in March of every year, we have a strategy progress report going forward so that we can cover that financial year and the forecast. And then in October, we present on the annual report, which is presented on the year past. Now, this year, the March session was cancelled. I don't know why. And I don't know what your program is going forward, obviously.
No, I'm trying to ascertain what you are used to insofar as this committee is concerned. Clearly, what we'll do next year is very much going to be dependent on how I then structure the program. But if what I'm trying to establish is that that's the practice, and I would want to hold to that practice. What we used to do, for example, in the committee that I chaired previously, was that we would see you on your annual report only next year, March, where we could engage with you on your year gone as well as your strategic plan going forward. So there's definite synergies in regard to that. And it's very difficult for us to assess your annual report and say, well, that's the end of it as it pertains to March, whatever. And, well, whatever happens in the future, we'll deal with it next year. So clearly, you know, there's a disjuncture. So now that I've caught Mr. Kotwald's eye, I know that you did want to ask a question. I don't think I gave you an opportunity. Are you around? Okay, I'm sorry about that. I'm confused about the bus. But please, Mr. Liebenberg, you want to just add to that, and then maybe even any closing remarks at this stage, because we are...
I think just to close on the KPIs, this is the first year in which we've attempted with DPE to put a shoulder compact together. We've never had one before. So many of the targets and objectives set were really based on our internal thinking of where we could get. I think it will become more sophisticated as most things are at the end of the day. But just in closing, I think we are going forward dramatically in the company. We are not there yet, and we should not have any illusions as to the work that we still have to do. With the support of DPE, DOD, very importantly, the engagement of National Treasury, who have not been part and parcel of the North Planning historically. Treasury are, you know, very important people, as most of you will know, and we did not take cognizance of that in the past. We're working closely with them now. So I think all in all, we're moving in the right direction, and hopefully on an annual basis, we can continue to show the level of improvement that we've showed in the past. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I think all that's left for me to do at this stage is to thank you for very well presented submission to this committee. Even people like me who are lawyers, not intellectual, can understand some of the complexities of the just in terms of the presentation. And I do want to thank you for that. And clearly, they're big issues going forward. Clearly, there are enormous challenges, not least of which is the global environment in which you operate, as well as the domestic ones for that matter. We do, when it comes to the stages in the portfolio committee, when we deal with our own strategy, we tend to focus on negatives. But from what I can gather, clearly there have been enormous positives as well. There have been big turnarounds as well. And in that regard, I don't think that should be necessarily lost on us. We engage with you for a limited amount of time, and we do tend to then focus on big challenges, and I imagine that you would understand that's just part of what it is that we do in the in regards to the report that we've asked you, we've taken note of all of the unstatements in that regard. Can I just ask you, and I don't want to put undue pressure on you, when would be the earliest that we can receive those reports so that we can report as such to the House and expect those reports from you by a certain date?
Chair, we would want to engage with DPE.
No, you engage with me.
What sort of timing did you have in mind?
Well, 2 weeks.
Okay.
2 weeks is good for you?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what date would that put us at? The 7th of November?
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
If you need a little more time, just tell me now, because 9th of November, good. Before 12 o'clock on the 9th of November, you will please be in touch with Mr. Romano now to just exchange details.
Yeah.
The reports come to him. All right? Thank you very much. If they don't come, you will be subpoenaed. I'm itching to do something justice, as I keep on saying to my committee members. Coming from that environment. So, but please, don't let it be later than it is. Thank you very much to all of you. Thank you so much to the team and members. Thank you very much for your attendance. I see everybody is running away. There are one or two announcements that I do want to make. The first is, I discussed with some of the ANC members yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to discuss it with the opposition members, but there's been some suggestion that one of the things that we need to do before we adjourn at the end of the year is to undertake a trip to